today on BPR. Is it the invasion of the body snatchers or an epidemic of mini-me's? Everybody is sounding and acting like Trump, from James Mattis on the parade to John Kelly on alleged abuse charges against Rob Porter. These men were supposed to be a counterpoint to the president. Now they act just like him. We'll open the lines and ask if you've had a boss who wields the same kind of power and influence over you. Then Alex Beam brings us an update on the infamous Fatbergs of London. You'll want to tune in for that. At noon, former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrea Cabral joins us to talk about the father of three gymnasts who went after abuser Larry Nassar.
For years, we thought Daniel Ellsberg acted alone in leaking the Pentagon Papers. Turns out there was an entire syndicate behind him. We talked to one of the men who was instrumental in the historic leaks. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm excellent.
Well, that's nice to hear. So call it, and I meant it, it's very nice to hear. Call it the invasion of the body snatchers, Marjorie, or an epidemic of mini-me's, or maybe this is what the beginning of Trump's world dominance looks like, but everyone around him acts like him. James Mattis and John Kelly, remember, originally regarded as the adults in the room charged with keeping the president on track, have instead gone off the rails with him. Take yesterday, just yesterday as an example. At a press conference, Mattis was urging Congress to move on the budget, saying uncertainty was bad for the military, laying out why it needed to be fully funded, insisting that every dollar counts. In the same press conference, excuse me, he defends the president's desire for a military parade.
As far as the parade goes, again, the president's respect, his fondness for the military, I think is reflected in him asking for these options.
Okay, on the very same day, which would have been yesterday, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly from Brighton down the street said he was shocked by abuse allegations against White House staffer Rob Porter, even though Kelly already knew about the allegations. If denying the truth is not a Trumpian tic, ignoring abuses against women certainly is. And then there's Dr. Ronnie Johnson, not yesterday, whose assessment of the president's health sounded more like a Donald Trump interior monologue.
In summary, the president's overall health is excellent. His cardiac health is excellent. Those things in combination with the excellent cardiac results that we got from the exercise stress test, I think, are very reassuring. Those things will make him much healthier next year than he is now, although his health is excellent right now. He has a lot of energy and a lot of stamina. The president had more stamina and more energy than just about anybody there. But I would say the answer to your question is he has incredibly good genes, and it's just the way God made him.
Everybody is acting like Trump. So we're opening up the lines and asking you, when have you been, let's call it, subsumed by someone else's personality and sensibilities? You had a boss whose dominance was hard to resist, impossible to reject. And if you've not had a boss who wanted you to be in his or her likeness, what about roommates, friends, lovers, that sort of thing? 877-301-8970. You know, there are two ways to look at this, and I only really presented one, Marjorie. One, that you essentially become that person.
Right.
It's almost like a variation on Stockholm syndrome,
exactly.
I think. But there's a flip side that I thought was expressed so brilliantly by Chuck Todd. Do you remember after the physical results came out? I think we had Chuck Todd on the next day or whatever day it was. Here is Chuck Todd giving an alternative explanation as to why the Mattis, this is more charitable, I guess, the Mattises, the Kellys, the doctors, all those people appear to be acting like Trump.
It is stunning to me the number of people who Trump wears down and will get even the most ethical people to lie about the dumbest thing. And can you imagine the doctors like, fine, you want to be 6'3"? Fine, be 6'3". I don't give a damn.
That's one of my favorite lines of the year. You want to be 6'3", you are 6'3".
Why not?
So we want to know if you've had, we're not, if you want to focus on what's going on Trump, the thing that's most troubling to me, by the way, is not the military parade. We're going to talk with Andrea Cabral at noon about this serial abuser who was the secretary for the president of the United States, this Rob Porter. And every report is suggesting that Kelly, despite praising him yesterday, knew about this months ago. 877-301-8970. If you want to talk about it in the context of the Trump administration, it's fine. We'd prefer to talk about it in the context of your own lives. If you've been involved in a relationship, again, whether a boss, a friend, a lover, a something, a coworker, where you have essentially become him or her because of their dominant behavior, or is that not a fair reading? And is the Chuck Todd analysis of the doctor, for example, sometimes you decide, I'm just going to give in. It is not, I can't fight every single battle. Sometimes I just have to do what he or she wants, even though I don't like it, and even though it may not be ethical, because there's only so much fight left in me.
Yeah, I think the latter may be very common in like marriages or your relationship with your parents or
and
your
coworkers
sisters
and
or brothers, where people, you know, they live in this kind of fantasy world and they remember your childhood. You're telling your story about your childhood and you're thinking that's not how it was or that's not what happened. Rose-colored glasses about things. I think that happens a lot in families.
And to quote Chuck Todd, you want to believe that? Fine,
yeah,
you can believe that.
Okay, fine. If you want to say, if you want to fantasize about the way we grew up or you want to fantasize about the marriage or whatever it is, what the heck?
Do you remember just a couple of months ago when Senator Corker was saying the generals are what stand between the American people and chaos?
Right.
And the maybe my chronology is wrong, but the change in each of these people, we don't hear from McMaster much.
No, he's gone under the radar.
We don't hear that much from Mattis. We obviously hear much more, frankly, much more than I'd like to these days about from General Kelly, particularly in light of his comment about the DACA non-applicants
Kelly's,
who were eligible
Kelly,
the other day.
Kelly, I think, has kind of gone off the deep end.
But again,
maybe he was already there and we just didn't
but
know.
But again, you work for a boss who's a pretty strong kind of person. So do you essentially become him because of the dominant nature of his personality, or do you do, again, the Chuck Todd thing, do you say, I just can't fight every single fight?
Or does the boss's dominance just allow you to live out the worst in you, like what Kelly said about the dreamers, which was so awful, or the way he attacked the congresswoman from Florida, which was a
lie
and was so awful, or the widow of a soldier who'd lost his life.
David Johnson.
Yeah, Niger.
Niger.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to pronounce that
sure.
wrong. But, you know, the other thing is, too, you wonder if part of it is that they're just placating the guy. That Mattis, okay, you know, much more upsettingly, he seems to have done a 180 on our nuclear weapon which is very scary. But you wonder if that's because he realizes that the boss is, you know, a little different, and he's doing this to placate him, and he figures, okay, if I got to talk about a military parade to get, you know, talk this guy down off the roof, or I've got to say what he wants to hear about nuclear weapons, even though I'm not going to do it, maybe that's another way of managing him.
Okay, and so a way to manage Donald Trump is to praise Rob Porter, who's a serial abuser of wives and women?
Well, I think Kelly, that's Kelly.
Kelly, General Kelly.
And I think Kelly, you know, something's happened to Kelly. Obviously.
877-301-8970. So if you want to talk about it in the Trump context, we're here for you. If you want to talk about it in your own lives context and give us some examples where you've done this kind of behavior, either because you've been worn down or because you essentially, day after day after day, become the person and the personality who you didn't really want to be or didn't, whatever.
You know what you hear about this, too? You hear this a lot about from your friends and in marriages, say, where somebody's got, like, a drinking problem. And, you know, the spouse knows the other spouse has a drinking problem. And it's amazing how many times you hear the same story over and over again, where the spouse with a drinking problem convinces the spouse without one that really they're crazy. They're imagining it. Or they think that their spouse is cheating. Oh, no, you're imagining this. You're just paranoid. You're just seeing all these things that aren't there. And they keep the one who's like the innocent party is thinking, okay, am I paranoid? Maybe he doesn't have a drinking problem. Maybe he's not really. Maybe the fact that he's going out seven nights a week until 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe he really is out with his buddies at the bar. You know, you begin to doubt yourself when you have somebody that's a really good talker.
Let's go to Ben in Holliston. You're first today on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for calling, Ben. Hi.
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 So I was thinking about, you know, the way that Donald Trump's speaking on the news and everything, and the way his doctor and all that. And in my line of work, I work in a residential home with a few other people, and we've all sort of developed our own language
mm-hmm.
in the way we speak. And it's, you know, a lot of third person talking, phrases like this is me taking out the trash or this is me being frustrated with you. And anytime that anyone else comes to our unit to work, whether it's a substitute worker, they all get confused. They don't really know what to think of it. You know, it's like this is me introducing myself.
And what's the motivation for that?
To fool the clients or so the clients don't know?
Not really. It's just it's humorous to us. We think it's funny.
Oh, okay.
It's sort of like a tactic to sort of make our day-to-day life a little bit easier.
Well, maybe that's what General Kelly and General Mattis
like a little
are doing.
Secret ben, language
thank
game
you.
kind of thing.
Thanks, Ben,
yeah,
for the
thank
call.
You, thank you for the call. Number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Let's go to CJ in Newton. Hi, CJ.
Hello, CJ.
Hi, thanks for having me. I've been listening to your show for years and absolutely love it. One of your biggest fans.
Thank you so much.
I'm actually calling, shockingly, not to bash Trump today, but to say that my beloved teenage son has the will of 1,000 men, and then the second one has the will of a nation, and he will wear you down until you're doing things for him that you never would ever imagine that you could do.
Okay.
Like what?
An example. We want an example. Give us one.
There is no way in hell you are ever driving your brother anywhere. And then maybe a husband sabotages the plan. And, you know, you're just in a position where the next day, okay, you have to drive your brother, but just this one time.
So, CJ, are you aware that you're capitulating, or is it a conscious decision, or do you just get mesmerized into capitulation?
There is no mesmerization. There is just dread. It is just awful exhaustion. I would say exhaustion.
Yeah.
At its worst.
So
yeah,
are you suggesting,
good one, though. Teenagers, that's a good one.
But are you suggesting that there may be a parallel between your relationship with your teenage kid and one of these generals and the president? The difference is you can't get rid of your kid. They could go find a new boss, right?
Yeah.
It's a relentlessness that it is. I'm telling you, I mean, obviously he's got the will. The president also has the will of a nation, and he will stop at nothing to get his way.
That was a great call.
Just like a teenager.
CJ, that was a great call. Thank you so much for making it. Who was the guy who apparently called Trump a moron? Was that Tillerson?
Tillerson.
Can't you see? I mean, this is, again, being charitable towards the generals and Tillerson. Can't you see all these guys, and it is guys, meeting in a room and saying, we're not gonna fight him today. As long as he's not dropping a nuclear bomb on North Korea, we'll give him this. We'll give him that. Again, that's being charitable to all these people. But if you choose to stay, and you can have a debate someday about whether or not it's moral to stay under those circumstances, but if you choose to stay, you do have to pick your spots, no?
Well, everyone always talks about how he loves to be flattered and he loves to hear that whatever it is the biggest and the best ever and all
that
kind of stuff.
Remember that first cabinet meeting?
Yes, where everyone around the room had to say, you're the most wonderful boss I've ever had. You're the most brilliant politician.
Led by
ever.
Reince Priebus, right?
Orrin Hatch. Remember Orrin Hatch said he was the best president since Abraham Lincoln or something like that? I mean, does Orrin Hatch really believe that? I don't know. But that's a way to handle the president. So maybe that's part of what's going on with Mattis. Okay. You want the tanks and the howitzers going down Pennsylvania Avenue? Hey, what the heck? You know what I'm saying? Small price to pay to keep the guy happy for another few days.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Tim in Worcester. Hey, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As Jim and Marjorie, you may know, I'm also referred as Tim the Shoe Guy.
Oh, hey, Tim.
Oh,
how
Tim
are you?
Tim the Shoe Guy. Hi.
What's going on?
Good. Well, you know, a long time ago, I used to have a boss, and we'd be in and of course, I sell shoes. We'd be in a buying situation. He'd pick up a shoe, and we'd be in a buying situation with the sales rep, and he would say, hey, Tim, we need the shoe, don't we? And he'd be shaking his head yes. Or if he didn't like it, he would shake his head no. So, you know, like, what am I going to do, you know? I mean, I know what the right thing to do is to speak my mind, but, you know,
That's a perfect example.
That is a perfect example.
But, you know, that's a perfect example. And most of the examples, I think, in most real people's lives, like you, Tim, me, Marjorie, the consequence is not huge.
Right.
I mean, if you do...
nuclear war.
Right, exactly. You say yes to the shoe, even though you don't need it, the consequence is not big. But the guys we're talking about, the consequences Marjorie suggests sometimes are huge, you know. But that's a great story, Tim. Thanks for calling in. It's a pleasure to speak to you, as always. 877-301-8970.
Okay, we're talking about President Trump and his legion of mini-me's with his cabinet members all acting like him. We're asking you if you've been in a situation where you started to act like your boss or your superior or somebody you were trying to placate or please. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about President Trump and how his cabinet members, four-star generals, many of them at least, have capitulated and are now acting like him. And we're taking your calls and asking if this has ever happened to you in any relationship with a boss, a colleague, a partner, etc. 877-301-8970, where the person was so dominant that you started to act like him or her under two circumstances. Either unconsciously, you morphed into that person, or a totally conscious decision that it's not worth the fight. I hate to keep quoting Chuck Todd, but it's my favorite line of our show of 2018 when he says, can you imagine the doctor is like, fine, you want to be 6'3"? You're 6'3". I don't give a damn. Remember the whole 6'3", 239-pound
yeah,
thing?
Yeah.
I thought Todd's analysis was exactly what the doctor had said. You know, I'm not, even though he did apparently misrepresent the heart situation, according to... the CNN doctor,
Sanjay Gupta and other cardiologists who weighed in about
that's a little more serious.
It is a little more serious.
I'm sorry. 877-301-8970. You pick it, Marjorie.
Let's go to Maureen from Haverhill. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Mine is actually the opposite, which goes to the fact of why they do this. Mm-hmm. I've been fired at least twice because I refused to capitulate.
Good for you. Like, give us an example of one of them.
Let's see. I work for a company that there was so much misogyny, it was not even funny. And women left there all the time. And then they caught the assistant manager embezzling. And instead of promoting the woman who had been there forever and knew the job, they brought a man in from the warehouse. If I was like, excuse me. Why didn't she get the job?
Wait, you said that?
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
And I got fired shortly thereafter.
Oh, yeah, but you can live with honor. I mean, don't you feel better in
absolutely.
The grand... I mean, really, yeah. Maureen, good for you. Thank you for the call and the story. It takes a little bit of courage, but you feel better about yourself, and you probably live a longer, healthier life, don't you think?
Even if you're unemployed. So. Lisa in Waltham, thank you for calling, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa. Lisa?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I go to the wrong line?
You did.
Is Lisa there?
We'll get back to you, Lisa, in 1 minute.
Yes, Lisa,
oh, you're there.
Lisa.
Sorry.
We got Lisa. Sorry. My mistake.
Yes.
Hi, Lisa.
So I once worked for a man who was the executive director of an agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in two men into the office. They announced themselves that they were from the FBI, said they wanted to speak to him.
Oh.
I sent them into his office. Later this afternoon, hours later, he comes into my office just to schmooze. And I said, what do those two guys want? And he said, what two guys? And I said, the two guys that were here this morning. And he said, there were no two guys here this morning. I said, the two guys. And he believes that you just, he once said to someone, just deny.
Deny.
You know, I see you doing it. Just, I don't believe he believed that it did, those two guys were there. But people around him started to question themselves. Like, weren't you guys here? Yes, I shook their hand.
You know, that is a classic one, because you see that all the time with workers or, like I said before, people in your family, you know, where people will deny, you know, you're passed out on the table after you've had too many beers. We see you leaving with some girl in a red car. People say, no, what are you talking about? That wasn't me. What are you talking about?
Well, by the way, this is the story of Sean Spicer, is it not? And many of the other people. It's a perfect parallel to what we've seen in the first 13 months or whatever it is of Donald Trump. Lisa, that's a great story.
Well, that's why Donald Trump doesn't surprise me at all.
Because you had a Donald Trump. Exactly. Thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970. The reason we're having this conversation, it's off yet really yesterday's news, is General Mattis just matter-of-factly talking about, yep, let's do a military parade. It reflects the president's respect and fondness for the military. And the reason I bring that up is most retired generals who I've seen on television the last few days were very critical of the notion that we should be doing some military.
Oh, I think 88% of the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan said they thought it was. There was some story about that.
Was a bad idea?
It was a terrible idea.
And then later in the day, which to me is 1,000 times more troubling from a guy who, in my opinion, gets more troubling almost every day, John Kelly, the chief of staff for the White House, former general, said he was shocked by the abuse allegations against this key White House staffer, Rob Porter, who, as we know, is a serial history of abuse of women, including wives. And at least according to virtually every single report I've read since last night, Kelly knew about this actually months before. So we're asking whether or not, since both of those things are Trumpian behaviors, we're asking you if you've experienced a situation because of the domination of your boss, your partner, or whatever, you've become that person. And if you have become that person, have you become that person voluntarily or without even thinking? You just morphed into him or her. 877-301-8970.
We should point out that there's a pattern of hiring people that are supposed wife abusers. Steve Bannon was charged with domestic violence and battery. And Andrew Pusner, the guy that he nominated to be the labor secretary, he had to resign after.
They're looking for another job for him, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, after his ex-wife had gone on the Oprah Winfrey show talking about how he had physically abused her. It was a much more minor incident with Corey Lewandowski accusing of grabbing slapping a Trump supporter's butt and grabbing another reporter extremely hard. That was much different. But at least two people, and Trump himself was accused by his wife, but she later denied it.
877-301-8970. Let's go
to first wife, I should say.
Brunier in Hyde Park, right? Not the current one. Brunier, you're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Good morning, Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I think we were pushing it slightly wrongly because Trump has put out a long manual of who he is, from the birther to the Mexicans to the judge to everybody else. So anyone who decided to work for Trump had some kind of innate thing, some dark side of themselves. That's why they were attracted to working with him. Principal Republicans would never work for Trump. Look at the Bushes. Look at other people like that. Trump and the White House is a magnifier. So it really magnifies who the person was. I think we all were duped by Kelly. Kelly had some issues that we could not see, but by working for Trump and the White House, now we can see who he really is.
Boy, that's a really interesting take.
Yeah, that's true. And again, I'm hoping, and maybe I'm being naive, that at least some of the people that are working for him, like McMaster, that we haven't heard from lately, or maybe Mattis, the idea of there being, you know, one step between us and kind of disaster kind of thing.
Well, they're obviously not acting that way, at least publicly. Brunier, the only reason, even though your analysis is a really sane one, the only reason I have some skepticism about it is because a lot of people who I respect, who I don't know, but whose reputation and I respect from what I know of them, spoke particularly of people like Kelly and Mattis and McMaster as incredibly honorable people who in the appropriate circumstances would stand up to an out-of-control Trump. And so at least according to them, they're not. It's not a shining a light on who they were, but that they've evolved or devolved into somebody else. But you may be right. You may be right, or maybe if they weren't that kind of person, they wouldn't have taken the jobs to begin with. Brunier, thank you very much for the call. Well, actually, you know, an exception to that is Mitt Romney is not Donald Trump, and Mitt Romney was anxious to be Secretary of State, I think, out of patriotism, don't you think?
Even though I
think he knew that Donald Trump was a danger on a variety of fronts, I think he thought that it was the right thing to do to serve your country.
And you also think that because there have been so many outrageous things in this White House, from the S-hole remark about where certain immigrants come from, to the, you know, the $130,000 payoff to the porn star, to the, you know, John Kelly insulting dreamers, that it's allowed people to think that that's okay. You know what I mean?
Well, speaking of okay, you know what's interesting? You and I have done many shows through the years about one of the topics I like the most, about sincere apologies. Mm-hmm. What's a real apology? How forgiving are we as a people when someone, you know, legitimately and unequivocally apologizes? Is, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the first apology was the Kevin Spacey thing, which was total BS because it morphed into an opportunity for him to say he was gay. I mean, everybody said that's not, you know, obviously it's not a real apology. He turned it around from the survivor to him kind of thing. You know what I find most troubling about Kelly? After having referred to a black congressperson, and I think that was relevant, in Florida as an empty barrel.
Right.
Because she allegedly bragged at the opening of a new, was it an FBI building?
Which was,
when in
not
fact,
true.
When the tape was shown subsequently, she praised the two FBI agents, not herself. And General Kelly was asked about an apology and he refused to do it. He said he wouldn't apologize. Well, now, if reports are true, and they're from multiple credible sources, that long before he praised Rob Porter for his character,
honor
his
and
wonderful
integrity.
Work, in fact, he knew that this guy was a serial abuser of women. Will he apologize for that error
well,
in
I
judgment
don't know.
Being kind?
But he has an example of someone who hasn't apologized for anything in his boss. So,
well, he sort of apologized in a very limited way for Access Hollywood, but that was like a one ever, right? Well, didn't he apologize? And
He did. I take that back. He did apologize for Access Hollywood because I think that he thought that that could
sink him
completely.
877-301-8970. Just another minute or two here. Marjorie, where do you want to go?
Let's go to Aisha in Arlington. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Hi.
Yes, Aisha.
Hi, Aisha. Sorry. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
I have a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to tell you that watching Trump reminds me of watching my father. A couple of years ago, I had to finally take away his car keys because the whole family was not able to stop him from driving. Mm-hmm. And he right now is in nursing home. He's unable to feed himself. He has dementia.
Oh, my goodness.
He was so paranoid. And he even called my mom's priest and accused her of having an affair, which, you know, if you knew my mom, you'd know it's ridiculous. He was angry at everybody. He had angry outbursts, and the way he was talking, his vocabulary was diminishing. It really reminds me of Trump, this facial expressions and anger, and you know, you couldn't really talk to him and nobody could stand up to him. And finally I basically took away the key because I knew that you know, if somebody dies while he's driving, it we will be responsible. And I wish there was somebody in the White House who would just basically take away the keys and say, you know,
that
you
is
are
great.
Not allowed to drive.
Well, you know,
Aisha, that
thank
is
you
great.
For the call and
thank
good
you.
Luck with your dad.
That is,
you know,
a perfect
in
image.
Your own quiet, understated way, seems to be
Melania
giving him
Trump.
The heave-ho. Exactly.
I knew you were going
to
say
you know,
that.
Pushes his hand away. Takes off, doesn't go off to Davos.
White
with him.
Suit at the State of the Union,
doesn't
a la Hillary Clinton.
So she's saying, basically, with
and the
her,
message is being conveyed, even though she, through her spokesperson, has said all that stuff was BS about why she didn't go to Davos.
Yeah, I think she's telling us what she thinks loud and clear. So good for her.
Boy, I love that last call, though, by taking away the keys. That's really, but that was the notion that Senator Corker was expressing, that when appropriate, the generals will take away the keys. And it appears, now maybe there are things we don't know about. Maybe their excess is far worse than those which we've seen,
which we'll read
about in 10 years.
Well, we heard about this during Nixon's last days in the White House, when his aides thought he was drinking too much and
Woodward
worried.
Woodward and Bernstein
that,
thing, right?
Yes, and worried that he may do something untoward, that there were orders that he was not to, you know, set off a nuclear war without somebody stepping in.
Remember the image of him and Kissinger, and he down on their knees? Yes, Kissinger. Isn't that in that book? To get down on his knees and pray with him, isn't that?
Yeah, they were. He and Billy Graham, when they were doing a lot of praying.
What was that called? The Final Day? What was that called?
The Final Days was one of Woodward. That was Woodward's book by himself, I think.
Okay.
But by the way, maybe they were together. I shouldn't have said that. But what did Maureen Dowd call Melania in her column?
Oh,
the Slovakian Sphinx or something like that.
Yeah.
Like that. If you haven't read it, it's a great piece about Melania Trump's.
Did you see the great Maureen Dowd interview this past
with
week?
Uma Thurman?
First interview with Uma Thurman.
Tim
about
Robbins,
Harvey
too.
Weinstein and all the others.
Okay, we're moving on. Coming up is Alex Beam.
There he is.
we're going to talk to him about a lot of things, including this heart-wrenching tale of Nigel, the lovesick seabird who just couldn't face another day. Alex Beam joins us for that and much more on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browning, Marjorie Egan. Here is in Studio 3 is Alex Beam. And as we do every single time, I think we forgot once.
We cruelly
but Alex is here. I'm talking to Alex.
Oh, sorry.
We marvel that his name is Alex Beam because when Alex writes, Marjorie said this, his words like an Alex Calder mobile spin and dazzle. Did you say that or was that me who said that this morning? Thank you.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
I think it was not I.
It was me. Hey, Alex, how are you? Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Jim. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Marjorie, nice to see you.
Marjorie, you speak first. That's how this show works.
Thank you very much. I seem to have lost your notes. I seem to have lost.
Okay, well, this is Alex Beam.
What are we starting with? That's what I'm confused
about. You ever heard of James John
Updike? Rabbit Run. Yeah. Oh, yes. We're talking about, and we talked about this yesterday with listeners, and it was a great segment about people's favorite books being turned into movies and which ones worked and which one didn't. And the reason we mention is because the Rabbit series, John Updike's great Rabbit Run and all the books that followed after that. Was it five more, I think? Is there six in total?
We made a mistake on the air. Remember when we got corrected by a Boston University academic?
We did?
Yeah. I mean, in a
number we got wrong
in
about?
In a good way. In a good way. I think we said there were three, and there were actually four.
Oh, there were four. Okay.
And there was a second one that kind of no one read, which is
because it's
tempting.
So depressing. The second one is so depressing. Rabbit is Rich. Rabbit and Rest. Rabbit at Rest.
Is the last one.
Rabbit Run. What's the one in the between?
Well, there's Rabbit Redux, so we can
name Rabbit
Redux,
four, okay.
But I think there's a fifth, then, that it was pointed out that we
Our
made
Our colleagues will check. Okay. Okay.
Fine, well, in any case, this is going to be turned into a TV thing.
Isn't it? I think, yeah.
Yeah, by Andrew Davies, this kind of legendary sort of rewrite.
So what do you think?
Well, I mean, good. It only said who's going to produce them, I think. It didn't say who's going to broadcast them. But, I mean,
I don't think it's been decided, actually. I think they said there were Matthew Gilbert writing in your paper, The Globe, I think said, is it PBS? Is it HBO? I think it's unresolved or at least not public yet.
Oh, I mean, it's obviously.
But how do you feel in those? I mean, the issue we discussed the other day, as Marjorie described, is when they're great, great works of art that are about to go onto a television screen or a movie screen. There's some trepidation in people who love that particular work. So how do you feel about this?
Well, not for me personally and not with these works.
Why?
For a number of reasons. I mean, there's almost a curatorial aspect to it, right? And excuse me for being over-seltzered here. We did Rabbit Run as on this show a couple years ago.
Book club.
Yeah, right. And there's a real concern, I think, that these quality modern novels by Updike, which I happen to like, are going to be lost to the next generation of readers. So I think the positive about them, and look, let's get real.
He's a bad guy for the Me Too moment.
Yeah. Well, Updike himself, of course, and Rabbit Angstrom.
His books are often criticized.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Having said that, they're obviously going to ride either on HBO, GBH, they're going to ride on a relatively quality programmer, right? And I think it's just going to be good. I mean, I guess Updike's kids will get a little bit of money, and that's good. But I'm happy for John Updike. I mean, you are right, by the way. He is edging towards oblivion day by day.
Yeah, which would be a horrible thing. Did you know, until Chelsea told us yesterday, or me, I don't know if you were still here, did you know there was a movie? A rabbit movie with James Caan as Rabbit Angstrom.
I didn't know that.
Did you see it?
I did see it. I remember seeing him having fights with his wife in the house, and she would come home and she was always hitting the old fashions or whatever she was doing there, and the horrible scene with the baby.
I love those books, and I think your argument is a good one, but I have some trepidation. So what's your favorite, a book we've actually heard of, Alex? What's your favorite book made into a movie or TV show, and what's your least favorite adaption?
I can't answer that question. However, the people who worship the darkness have always loved the so-called Patrick Melrose novels, and those are coming to television with Benedict Cumberbatch
playing
Patrick Melrose. I'm not exactly sure again who's
I've never read those.
The, they are the darkest novels ever written. And I'm so embarrassed. I'm not immediately bringing the name of the author. It's a British author, Saint Somebody. Your listeners know who this is, and they're coming up this fall. They're going to be amazing. So I'm really looking forward to that.
He is nothing short of fabulous, Cumberbatch. It's not just Sherlockian. The guy is
You're
going to
like the
so
Patrick
Alex,
Melrose
novels. We were talking a minute ago about how General Kelly
Audrey St. Aubin.
Thank you. My
about how
stuck, so
General Kelly should be apologizing for some things he's said of late. And this is your opportunity, with a lot of people listening, an opportunity for you to apologize for what you wrote. Because last time we were with you, we talked about the smackdown between you and Marjorie Egan a week ago Monday.
On the Pope.
About the Pope. And you probably know there's been a development on the Chilean front since we last saw you. Did you see the Associated Press story? When the Pope said, I haven't heard from the victims, in fact, there's clear documentation that Cardinal O'Malley delivered a letter to him in 2015 from a well-known victim.
This is
actually a pro-choice Catholic magazine called Conscience.
My point exactly.
Yes, and on the cover they have a big picture of the Pope with his, I don't know what you call the thing he wears, this part of his stole blue in the wind over his face, and the big caption is Francis blind spot.
But you know, on a serious note, the fact that, I mean,
relentless.
This is borderline complicity. It's one thing to be willfully ignorant of maybe the worst thing that's happened in the Catholic Church in the last century. He knew. A letter was delivered to him by O'Malley.
I'm not going to sit here and take your left-wing liberal
point. Why? Am I wrong?
Okay, you're wrong on two
the
points.
Factual?
You're wrong on two points. Everything you've said is quote-unquote true, but there is no evidence that the Pope actually saw or read the letter. We know the letter was delivered. The Pope gets a lot of letters.
There's a photograph of O'Malley giving it to him, isn't there?
Yeah, but there's no,
good for Sean O'Malley.
If there's no photograph of him. No, seriously. You can mail a letter to the White House. That doesn't mean Donald Trump read it. And B, I can't believe you're not mentioning, I thought when you said there's a new development, the interesting new development is the Vatican's order and inquiry.
Yes. Yeah, we talked about that the other day. You're trying to score cheap points to defend her against me.
That's the more interesting thing, is that the Vatican is actually going into this.
Do you have anything to say here or not?
No, I don't.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, so you need to back off.
No, I'm not going to back off. And by the way, I love the good things this Pope has done, but I would argue the behavior on this front, as I said to you last week, and I'll say to you even more passionately now, are all obliterated by this willful blind spot around this horror in the Catholic Church.
If you watch Jim's award-winning TV show, which is on every night at 7 o'clock, Greater Boston, starring Jim Brown,
he trashed you mercilessly
last night. I bet nobody told you that, did they?
What, he mentioned my name?
I trashed you.
Don't you dare, man. My name's trademarked.
I did not. You know, I was going to do it, but I forgot your name, so I couldn't.
That's fine. I was watching E. However, I submit to Marjorie, it's acts, not words, my friend. It's acts, not words.
Acts is a good point.
Of the Pope and the Vatican here are criticism received, reopening inquiry.
Excuse me, how is the Pontifical Commission chaired by O'Malley done on assault of minors? How's that done?
I'm addressing your narrower question about Chile.
And how is that done?
Well, we're going to see, because there's going to be a new investigation in Chile.
We're going to see. Yeah. I think there's the
you're always on thin ice,
you know,
by the way.
You might see the bishop doing a
prayer.
What's the name of the final survivor?
Take him out in cuffs.
What's Marie's
last? Marie Collins.
Marie Collins. Do you know why she resigned as the last survivor Pontifical Commission?
Disgusted.
Her great demand was that the Vatican send out a letter, not even do anything, send out a letter to people who said they were survivors. And you know what their position was?
I'm sure.
We're not doing it.
I'm sure the fig. Yeah, I'm sure they gave her the
We're
fig.
Talking to Alex.
Okay, I'm not Catholic, man. I always feel comfortable saying that. Yeah. No concerns in my religion.
I'll tell you what. Let's get to a much more pressing issue. Why these poor black cats are shunned at the rescue shelter?
Oh, this is actually unbelievably
unbelievable. For
you. No, this should be one of your call-outs instead of these boring subjects that you choose. Yeah, oh, sorry. I take that back. We're off the air right now. This is really interesting. Yeah, but it's more complicated than that. Even though that's the headline.
Yes.
I mean, I apologize for being in lecture mode, because the headline says shelters can't find homes for black cats. And because people don't want to take, they don't look good in selfies. We'll get into that in a second.
Incredible.
But actually, it's more, and so it, you kind of get, oh, wait, black, that they're discriminating against black. It's a whole black thing. It turns out it's a white thing, too. They can't find homes for either mono, for basically for monochromatic cats.
Which is so weird.
That are either black or white.
Because isn't one of the most beautiful cats in the world a black cat with blue eyes or green eyes? I mean, give me, I totally agree.
And what's the matter with an, I mean, as long as we're getting like racialist about it, what's the matter with an all white cat?
An all white cat, it's fine too. They show the dirt. Black white, black cats don't, and there's something really neat about the...
I cannot believe we had two animal stories for Alex, and you choose the one about black cats when one of the most heart-wrenching stories I've ever read in my life.
We're not finished with cats.
This
we're not finished
American
with
cats. Tragedy.
Stay on the cats for
we got to finish with the cats because it turns out that it's these horrid young people, these horrid millennials, all want to take pictures of themselves with calico cats and ginger-colored cats. And I guess black cats are and white cats are considered like too run of the mill. It's like these idiots. They go to the restaurant. They never eat. They spend the whole time taking pictures of their food. I mean, it's terrible. So we need to urge listeners to go to the shelter and adopt black and white cats.
Okay, now,
that's our message of unity.
And seabirds, actually.
And seabirds.
This is one of the saddest stories I've ever read. I mean, I remember Sunday morning, it was in the paper. This was flying around like crazy. People were beside themselves about the death, the life and death of Nigel, the world's loneliest
seabird. It's not funny. It is one of the most painful things I've ever read in my life. Because everybody could put themselves in this position.
I think you're identifying much too strongly.
Could you tell the story of this?
Well, Nigel is this lonely seabird on this island in New Zealand. They couldn't get anybody. It's called a gannet. Rhymes with Janet is the name of the bird.
Exactly. Yeah.
But anyway, poor Nigel is kept preening and cooing to this bird decoy made of concrete. Nigel would nest next to this concrete bird. Nigel would try to mate with this bird to sing and talk to this bird. And of course, the bird would never reply because it was a concrete decoy, which Nigel didn't realize. And then poor Nigel died of a broken heart.
There's a little bit of Nigel in all of us,
right?
It's like 20 years of marriage.
Exactly. I got an email from a friend of mine who said, "There's my life."
He said, "There's my obit." I saw that.
Did you see that one too?
Yes,
"There's my obit."
I got it too.
Nigel the lonely.
He said,
seabird.
"I am Nigel." I is what he said.
Oh,
we cannot say who it is.
We cannot. Oh, that's right. You were on the thing too.
I was
too.
On the thread.
Well, we'll put in a tiny bit of context, which is largely unnecessary. But I guess it actually is sort of interesting. New Zealand, because it's a small and can kind of do what it wants. It's floating in the middle of the ocean. Wants to purge everything that wasn't there before, specifically rats, because rats can't travel to New Zealand on ships.
So they're taking portions
of New Zealand and trying to purge them completely of things that weren't there before and bring back things that were there before, which includes these large colonies of seabirds called gannets. And so this is an island northwest of Auckland where they installed beautifully colored, hand-colored concrete gannets to lure other gannets to come home. There's no more rats, no more fearsome predators. And Nigel, I guess...
Nigel was the only one who showed up.
There were three.
The video, I'm sorry. If you Google Nigel gannet, and you see this, both of you are laughing. It is so horrible. Why are you laughing?
We're crying. It's laughter through tears.
Yeah. If you see
it's
the video...
I laugh at things that upset me.
Nigel sidling up, if that's the proper verb, to this concrete, and by the way, they look exactly like Gannett. I mean, it looks exactly like Nigel, except out of concrete, and it is really, really painful. But the love of Nigel's life
kept a cold silence.
But don't they say in the story? It was the New York Times, right? Don't they say that Nigel's life was not in vain? That some good thing happened because he lured the other two gannets there.
Now there's hopes.
And you know, the other two gannets ignored him.
Yes,
right?
I know.
They ignored him.
Nigel was an outcast. Remember, we once talked about these Japanese dummies and stuff. I mean, a little bit like, I mean, all of our social lives is heading towards interacting exclusively with either robots or or concrete models.
Well, you know, who's done a good job on a similar front? We've had him on the show. You're another Globe columnist, occasional now. Derek Jackson did all that puffin stuff.
Oh, the puffins!
I can't remember what the island.
But they
name
were not
is.
Alone.
No, my point is that essentially they have brought back the population of puffins,
that's right.
Which was verging on extinction, at least on that particular island. We're talking to Alex
so
Bean.
So here's the lesson for readers. If you're having a tough time on Match.com, read about the life and death of Nigel and understand it could be much worse.
That's
it could
not
be
very
much
heartening.
Worse.
Excellent.
Alex,
your
piece, I never heard of the National Digital Public Library. I thought it's great. What is the controversy around this, and why is there a controversy?
Okay.
Explain what it is, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, this was a trying piece for readers, although I'm pretty sure pretty much no one read it, but it's a subject that interests me.
I skimmed it.
Okay. No,
I read the whole thing.
God bless you.
It's a great point.
That's because it did ran in your place.
That's right.
Just kidding.
I know.
Okay,
I was bumped, actually, on Monday.
Yeah, well,
you'll be by the Patriots.
All right, I've been genuinely interested.
I was in Tuesday. You didn't see it.
I don't know. The whole point is, you know, we've had the internet for basically 20 years, and we've had three super well-funded, important attempts to create a national digital public library. It sounds very simple. And I'll get to what I wrote about in a second, but I've always had a residual anger, which I didn't have time really to voice in this piece. Most of our listeners remember Google Books, because Google Books is sort of still exists in a complicated way. And so, you know, Google had this idea they're going to digitize every book, and you'd have free access to every book, and they would pay the authors of books that were still in print, still under copyright. Anyway, the whole thing really got blown up. And then Robert Darnton, who at the time was the librarian of Harvard, declared with some quite amazing fanfare that only a Harvard librarian could muster, that he, once Google had failed, that he was going to do this very same thing, you know, in sort of the more of a public sphere as a kind of nonprofit effort. That cratered. Anyway, to fast forward to right now, there's quite a controversy because, again, a lot of people have probably heard of the Internet Wayback Machine, which has gotten a lot of attention and is kind of unbelievably fascinating. It purports to be a catalog of every web page ever created. Like, there's 278 billion of them. And they're a nonprofit group called the Internet Archive, based out of San Francisco, created the Wayback Machine, which journalists use quite a bit, by the way, because people try to kill web pages, of course, that have derogatory information. Okay. This guy, he's best known as the individual Brewster Kahle. For a few years, he has been trying to create a digital public library, and he's been asking authors, crazily, to send him their books. And his theory is that he's creating an imitation of an actual library. For instance, if you wrote a novel called My Life as a Gannet, you send it to Brewster Kahle, and he asserts, I have Marjorie Egan's novel here. I will either lend you the hard copy, or I've scanned it, I will lend you a digital copy. But it's my copy, meaning you gave it to him, you sent it to him. I'm only going to lend the scan one unit at a time.
As if it were an actual hard book.
Precisely. As if we went to that office over there and said, hey, I'd like to lend you this book. And as I write in this piece rather cynically, this is a non-existent legal doctrine, as yet non-existent, called right of digital first sale, meaning that if I bought a copy of your book at the bookstore, I could scan it and loan the scan to someone else. This is not only a gray area, it's a black area where law is concerned. But he's done this to 4 million books. And very tritely, by the way, thank you for letting me run on here, very tritely I point out at the end that two of my books are on the Internet Archive.
Oh,
a number of authors are unhappy, correct?
Yes. The Authors Guild, which I used to be a member of, which fought tooth and nail against Google Books and sued them in famous litigation that made it all the way to the Supreme Court, which denied review. The Authors Guild again is opposing very vehemently the Internet's archives attempt to create a national digital public library. And their point, which I really didn't have time to give full voice to, remains a valid one. Authors and book publishers, and there's a little footnote here in a second, still oppose this because they feel that this purported right of first sale that doesn't exist is taking money from Marjorie,
sure,
who wrote the novel and is not exactly saying, hey, everybody, you can give this out for free. it's so complex because, of course, actual libraries get involved. Actual libraries lend out digital copies, but they pay to do that. It is a subject of bewildering complexity. The one footnote I simply wanted to add, and where I wasn't exactly 100% honest with the readers, I said I had two books available on the Internet Archive, but those are kind of books that are, shall we say, way in the rearview mirror. The books that I still get tiny, tiny royalties from that are still quote-unquote in print are not on the Internet Archive.
Oh, good.
So, Alex, we're running out of time.
Yeah, I know, I get it.
Before, you have a tough choice, the Fat Burger or the Explainer?
No, we don't have to. Before you gave it away. Before the Explainer,
oh,
I was going to say to you, Alex, if I chose to go to the Museum of London next time I'm in the UK, why would that be? Because the Fatberg that we talked about ad nauseum with Alex, look it up. We don't have time to talk about it. There's a Fatberg now on display or about to be on display.
I thought this was a cruel ad hominem attack on me, frankly.
No, I love the Fatberg.
Oh, okay.
One of the great things. We're not even going to tell you what it is. Go Google it and then call us back.
This was another day. We can come back
there
and talk
about
it.
Okay, now what is the Explainer? We have about a minute here. What's the Explainer?
This is utterly fascinating. Returns to the Nordic roots
that
all three of us share.
What is that?
We're going to explain Isbiltur.
What?
It probably
might be pronounced Eisbiltur.
Eisbiltur.
Yeah,
okay, we have 45 seconds. The 45-second explainer that Alex does every week. Start the clock, judges.
Genuinely fascinating. Biltur is Icelandic for road tripping. Mm-hmm. And Eisbiltur is Icelandic for ice cream road tripping, which is huge in Iceland. Quick footnote.
Yeah.
What region of the United States sells more ice cream per capita than any other region?
New England.
Yes, good, exactly.
We do?
Yeah, ice cream's very popular in cold climbs. It's
really?
Super popular in Iceland. Everyone is doing it right now. Before the horn goes, I want to mention that hilariously, one of the great authorities on this subject is Íris Sveinsdóttir.
Yeah, he was on last week.
Of course, a classic Icelandic name, which means Iris, daughter of Svein.
Exactly.
Oh, really?
So I think the three of us need to go on an ice cream road
again?
Trip.
They
what's
ride around in their cars.
Eisbiltur.
Okay, thank you.
Do they ride around in their cars eating ice cream? Is that what they do?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like a thing.
That's right.
Oh. It's like a thing.
Yeah.
Eisbiltur.
Do they have cones or cups?
What?
In cones, man.
Cones. Yeah.
Who's been to Iceland?
Challenge.
In this room? Who's been to Iceland?
No, that was
not
really
me.
Important.
Oh, you
got
to go.
Okay.
Now we have more reason to go.
That's it.
That's right.
Okay.
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 Gosh,
Alex
Beam
stay.
Joins us every week. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe. His latest book is The Feud, Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, and the End of a Beautiful Friendship. Alex, as always, wonderful to talk to you. Coming up, one of Trump's top staffers is stepping down because of domestic abuse allegations. In the Me Too era, will this scandal be hard for the White House to shake? Former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety Andrew Cabral joins us for that and more, that is, next on 89.7 WGBH.
At noon on today's BPR, one of Trump's top staffers is stepping down because of domestic abuse allegations. Allegations that the Trump administration knew about. In the Me Too era, will the scandal be hard for the White House to shake? Former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral joins us for that and more.
Harvard leaders are demanding that the university's next president have the conviction to stand up to President Trump. But across the river, did a Northeastern professor take this too far by saying he wouldn't mind if President Trump were dead? Former Secretary of Education Paul Revel joins us for that and other education headlines. For nearly half a century, we thought Daniel Ellsberg acted alone in leaking the Pentagon Papers. Turns out an entire syndicate was behind the leak. We talked to one of the members about the role he played in U.S. history. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. And you are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, Loic and Jim.
By the way, if people are listening carefully to your voice, they could probably tell that you were just digesting part of a bagel right before you went on the air. Do you know that?
Did you have to out me?
No, I mean, it was obvious, and I felt I had an obligation to tell the truth to our listeners.
Okay.
I ate my bagel during the break. Joining us for another edition of Law & Order is former Suffolk County Sheriff and former Secretary of Public Safety, Andrea Cabral. Hello there, Andrea.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
How are you?
Hello, Andrea. Great to talk to you, as always. So let's start with this very distressing story out of the White House. about the staff secretary to the chief of staff, John Kelly, who apparently was known for some time now as having not both his first wife and his second wife accuse him of abuse. What do you make of this, Andrea?
Well, there are so many different facets to this particular story. None of them are particularly savory. The job, the person in question is a guy by the name of Rob Porter, and
yep.
he's been, he has two ex-wives.
Two ex-wives.
Both of whom, as you say, have accused him of being abusive, and this is all information that was told to the FBI when he joined the White House and was applying for security clearance, which he never got. And as the secretary to the to Trump, he sees a bunch of classified information. He sees everything that gets every piece of paper. That's how they phrased it. Every piece of paper that goes on Trump's desk.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have a security clearance. And this was the thing that kept him from the security clearance. This clearly the FBI would have conveyed this to the White House, so they certainly knew. And they not only kept him on in a capacity that warrants the highest security clearance, they never addressed any of the underlying reasons for his failure to get a security clearance, which is domestic abuse. But if you look at that in the overall, it's unsurprising if you look at it in the overall context of Steve Bannon having been accused of domestic violence, Andrew Putzner having been accused of domestic violence, and Trump's history of sexually assaulting women. So in one respect, I am not at all surprised that they chose to ignore it or diminish it at all. But the fact that it actually, you know, like it did with Bannon and Putzner, crossed over to a level of security clearance where this person who can be compromised by virtue of this information has access to classified information and could be blackmailed is unbelievable.
You know, here is, if I can just play, many of his colleagues at the White House praised him, at least initially. Here's Sarah Huckabee Sanders talking about Porter's performance as a key staffer for the president.
Rob has been an effective in his role as staff secretary, and the president and chief of staff have had full confidence and trust in his abilities and his performance.
And as you know, so did General Kelly. We talked about that earlier. So did Orrin Hatch, for whom he worked, until all of a sudden the information went public and they started changing their tune. You know, so much of this, I mean, this, there's certain things that are troubling about politics in Washington. This, to me, goes beyond troubling when a serial abuser, where apparently his abuse is known by people in power and they continue to use him. And as you said, the whole issue of access to certain documents and reports and all that sort of thing. The reason I think this one may concern the political people in the Trump administration more than others, I may have the number wrong, 50-some percent of married white women voted for Donald Trump. You know, despite that tired line that we've all recited 5,000 times from Trump on the campaign, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose anybody. This story to me is one that has greater potential to erode support. Marjorie, you're making a face at me like you don't agree?
Well, he's resigned. Steve Bannon.
They knowingly
had Steve Bannon in there for months and months and months. And as you recall in the Steve Bannon cases, the cops came to the house and saw red marks on her neck and wrist when she claimed that he had physically assaulted her. So in some ways, I think that because of the Me Too movement, he's gone. And I don't know. Maybe he might not have gone so fast without the Me Too movement, but maybe I'm all wet. What do you think, Andrea?
Well, I kind of agree. Ironically, I kind of agree with both of you. On the one hand, I think what's interesting about what Jim said is it's clear that the only lens through which they would see this as a detrimental thing would be a political one, because they clearly were completely indifferent to the underlying facts, as I said, that caused him to not get the security. It doesn't bother them that he's an abuser, because they've had other abusers in the cabinet and appointed to the National Security Council. I do agree somewhat with Jim that this might resonate a little bit more because it's just one story after the other. But I also, Marjorie, see your point about this is just the latest thing. This is not singular. This didn't happen in a vacuum. It wasn't just one person. And his support within that base of support has remained steady no matter what horrible thing happens in the White House. So I'm not sure exactly. I know it will motivate, you know, women who are not in favor of Trump to really make sure that they're getting out there to vote and that they're registering other people to vote. It's absolutely going to be have a mobilizing effect because it's yet another confirmation of what we know about this administration and how dangerous they are. I don't know exactly what the amount of impact it will have on his base. I suspect some, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was less than most people would think it should be.
We're talking to Andrew Cabral. Did either of you, I was looking up a piece of the story, so I may have missed this. Did either of you mention the Hope Hicks connection here?
No, not yet. They're dating.
By the way, I don't care at all were it not for the second fact. I'm going to mention that he's dating Hope Hicks, who's the communications person. That is his business, has nothing to do with this, except for the fact, and, you know, I'm not an ethics lawyer. She helped draft the statement that was put out by the White House responding to allegations of physical and psychological abuse by her boyfriend who works in the White House. Does anybody see that as a, I don't know, a conflict, a problem, a something, or no?
Yeah, I think it's an enormous problem that she was involved in this at all. I think it's a problem that she, as a woman, is choosing to discount the accounts of two prior women who have both been married to this man, Rob Porter, and who know him well, because right now, you know, she's having a good relationship with him. But I do see it as a conflict. But I also see it as a huge conflict that Sarah Huckabee Sanders used a White House press briefing to read that statement, literally into the public record. So essentially, it's the White House endorsing Porter and Hope Hicks's claim that these claims against him are vile and false.
Yeah,
I mean, they're all in on this. No matter how much they backtrack, they are all in on this. But as I say, it is the latest absolutely heinous thing, which in any other administration, in and of itself, would be fatal. The fact that it's that, you know, there are so many things to talk about in this administration that should have been fatal that aren't, is a sad, sad commentary on Congress and the state of affairs in this country and what people are tolerating in their politics.
Well, you know, but to belabor this for about 10 more seconds, as you said, Andrew, earlier, things that ordinarily would be a huge problem in other times are not in this administration. But what's also different in the other direction is we are still in the middle of this Me Too movement thing. And, you know, it can force one of the most powerful heads of a publicly traded corporation out of his business, Steve Wynn, who virtually nobody is defending, but people in the White House continue to defend, less so, I should
say.
Well,
I think they are taking a different tack now. I mean, it was pretty powerful stuff.
Why are they not condemning his behavior? You know, it's one thing to go from his character and integrity or above reproach to more.
I think that Kelly said there was no place in the world or the White House or whatever for domestic.
Was that
That was not his initial remark. That was his backtracking remark. I mean, you can't really defend domestic violence. And I would assume that Hope Hicks is not going to be dating this guy anymore.
But he knew. The reason that the backtrack is a big giant lie is because he knew. And up until the point, even when it was the facts were outed, he still defended him and only backtracked when there was photographic evidence of just how heinous his defense of this
guy was. But don't you think, Andrea, with all these guys, it's the same story. People say, well, you know, these women are making this up. Oh, she was trying to get more alimony in the divorce. Oh, you know, somebody else punched her in the eye and that's why she had this picture taken and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I think that's what's so significant about this Me Too moment is that some of us still doubt women's accounts, but for the most part, because they're almost never made up, that perspective has changed.
I'm sorry. I heard what you said, and I'm going to read the actual quotes after the fact with Kelly. Again, after the fact when this was all made public, not after when he knew, because he's known for months, according to all the court's accounts. He does say, "I was shocked by the new allegations released against Rob Porter. No place for domestic violence in our society." But listen to what he goes on to say in the same statement. "I stand by my previous comments of the Rob Porter that I have come to know since becoming chief of staff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." That's what you say about someone whose domestic violence you were condemning. And by the way, before you leave the room, let me just say I stand by what he said. Great guy in the time I've worked with him at the White House.
We just finished talking about how John Kelly has seems to have lost his ability to apologize for absolute slanders he said against the congresswoman in Florida. He was totally wrong when he trashed her, and he has yet to apologize for that or to the widow.
Factually wrong, we should say. We don't mean morally wrong.
Factually wrong. And the other day he said that dreamers that hadn't applied for the program were too lazy to get off their asses or whatever he said.
That's what he said.
You know, so there's something amiss, if you ask me, with John Kelly being is so close to Donald Trump.
I don't think that's what it is. I think John Kelly is right now who he is who he has always been.
That's what a Brunier said on the phone to us earlier this morning. A caller, go ahead.
It's projection. Everyone was so desperate for there to be a thinking adult in the White House.
Exactly right.
How pathetic is that when you can't rely on the President of the United States to be a thinking adult in any given room, that they projected onto John Kelly this measure of sobriety, critical thinking, honesty, and integrity, to which it seems to me he was never entitled. And now that he is himself, and they're sort of saying, well, that's the Trump effect. Well, I don't buy that. I think that you draw people to you who are like you and who defend you, but you don't turn them into you just by your physical proximity to them.
You know, by the way,
he's
first word,
because he wants to be there.
The first words, again, from the thing that Marjorie referenced when he said, I am shocked by the new allegations. Just one more time, according to various news sources, he was not shocked at all because he apparently knew about the accusations against months before.
I think we have to write him off. I'm still hoping for McMaster and Mattis to be in that circle
can
of maybe.
I just
maybe,
add one more
what?
Thing about that. He knows they're not, like to Jim's point, he knows they're not new allegations. But what you notice about this administration and actually the GOP Congress is they know that they're lying.
I know.
But what they realize is that a knowing lie that is repeated over and over and over again until it embeds itself in the public's conscience, When the truth later comes out, you still have at least half of those people who heard it believe the lie is the truth. That's why they do it.
That's the Roy Cohn effect.
We have had the head of Homeland Security in the testimony when she was before Congress, and those two senators, Cotton and the other guy from Purdue, both lied about what they heard Donald Trump say about S-hole countries. All three of them lied. And you're right. Has anybody paid a price for that? And I think that's sort of what's happening, is that the president himself has not apologized. He did apologize sort of for the grabbing the women by their genitals when he got caught for doing that. But generally, he doesn't apologize, and the people around him don't apologize. And you're right. I think the hope is that people who follow him and admire him will just believe. Or I don't know what they believe.
And that's the danger, where truth doesn't have a meaning anymore.
We're talking.
Truth is what I want it to be, and that's the most dangerous thing to happen in any representative democracy.
Andrea Cabral, we are speaking to. So, Andrea Cabral, in your years as a courtroom prosecutor, did you ever have the relative of a victim attempt to go after the defendant, like the father of three gymnasts attempted to do? After he asked the judge if he could have 5 minutes alone with Larry Nassar, and then he said, I'll take 1 minute alone. The judge said no to both, and then he lunged at Nassar. Did you ever have an experience like that?
I've been in the courtroom when it has happened on another prosecutor's case. I never had it happen in a case that I was prosecuting, but I have seen it.
And the judge, Janice Cunningham, said after the fact there was, quote, no way she would fine the father or send him to jail under her contempt of court powers. Was that the right decision?
I think she took into consideration heat of the moment. I mean, we excuse people who claim heat of the moment as a defense where they have murdered someone. I think a father standing in a courtroom having to listen to his daughters read into a public account and hear again from them what this man did to them, I think is something that would provoke any person to at least want to do that, and would provoke a few to actually trying to do it.
You know, I'm totally with you, and I've said this many a time on the show when we've been talking about the sex abuse, the sexual assaults in the Catholic Church, not so long ago, that I'm amazed. I'm not a pro-vigilante person at all. I'm amazed there isn't more of this kind of thing. Are you? I mean, you've been right in the middle of the passions of people who suffered horrible losses as a result of the criminal, immoral behavior of someone else. And I am amazed, how respectful of the system so many survivors or non-survivors, families and loved ones are. Are you?
I am. And I think, and when it doesn't happen, I'm always immensely proud of those people for the level of restraint that they show and the level of respect for the institution they show. Not just because of what it says about them personally, but because it always reinforces to me how important having faith and respect in sort of the institutions of democracy, and the judicial system is one of those, is in this country. And the fact that people continue to comport themselves, you know, in a respectful manner under the worst of circumstances does make me proud of them. But I'm not surprised in certain cases where people just, I mean, here's a father who is thinking probably nothing but I couldn't protect my daughter.
Exactly.
And
I
this
agree.
Guy is sitting right in front of me. And Larry Nassar has been described through various court proceedings as fairly smug and self-pitying. And I assume he just couldn't take it anymore.
Well, especially, remember, not only described that way, but the letter that was tossed aside by one of the sentencing judges just a couple of weeks ago, where he was basically saying it was all trumped up, it was all BS. And this, again, this is a week before the most recent sentencing that we were all hearing about. So I think that is often just too much to take. So I am totally with you, totally with the judge, and not advocating it, but totally understanding the behavior of the father. I would like to think I'd probably do the exact same thing. We're talking to Andrew Cabral, former Secretary of Public Safety.
You know, Andrew, often we talk about police shootings involving African-Americans, unarmed African-Americans in big cities. This one that has just broken into the news is a fatal shooting by U.S. Park police officers of a 25-year-old Bijan Gaiser, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and Fairfax County Police caught it on camera. I don't know what he is. He's not an African American. Maybe he's Middle Eastern. I don't know. But in any case, he's pulled over for a traffic violation. And what happened?
Yeah, I think it was a minor.
A minor traffic accident. I'm
like
sorry.
Sort of a fender bender kind of thing.
And he left the scene, which obviously he shouldn't have done.
Right. And so the Park Police, who actually they're a federal police agency. They protect government property in D.C. They responded to it, so this had to have happened somewhere where they had jurisdiction, so near government property. But they were joined by the Fairfax County Police because there was a minor traffic accident. He then drove away. I think they pursued him, and he stopped a couple more times, and then I think as they were about to approach the car, sort of went, you know, put the car in motion and drove away again. I didn't read any account that said that he drove away at a high rate of speed, but ultimately, when they caught up with him, this guy, by the way, he was 25 years old. He's an accountant. He's from McLean, Georgia. He was on the George Washington Memorial Parkway. That's what it was.
Yeah.
So when they finally do catch up with him, they shoot into his car 9 times. This is the Park Police. He's driving a Jeep, and he was hit 5 times out of the 9 shots. He died 10 days later. The Park Police didn't release the video. The Park Police don't have body cameras, but the Fairfax Police did release the video, and the chief, it seemed to me, the story that I read about the chief releasing the video was he became frustrated with their lack of disclosure. And since he had control over the video because it was his police officer's dash cam that caught it, he thought it was in the public interest to release it. And that's an unusual thing for one department to sort of go against the wishes of another. But it's apparently, I didn't watch it because I just kind of couldn't, but it's a terrible video from all accounts. And there doesn't seem to be a reason why they did this. He was unarmed.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like they just kind of lost their temper because this
right.
guy kept driving away from them, which, again, he shouldn't have done. But he didn't deserve to wind up with multiple bullet holes in him. And you wonder about the training of the U.S. Park Police officers, too, that they would fly off the handle like this. You know?
Well, it's not that different from so many other cases that we've read of from police departments, you know, around the country. I think they, you know, as part of the autopsy, I think they did a toxicology report that showed that this man wasn't intoxicated. It was a minor traffic accident. There's always a possibility that someone doesn't realize that they've been in a traffic accident, which is why ultimately when you do approach them, you want to ascertain whether or not they even know what they did, that they did anything wrong, because if that was the case here, he might have thought that the police were just after him for no reason, and he might have been frightened.
Yeah.
Which is why, even though he wasn't speeding away from them, he kept moving away from them. But the point is that you make sure that you're getting some of the facts, that you're approaching the car cautiously, but you don't fire into the Jeep at all. You should be able to avoid that unless the person clearly has a weapon, and this man was unarmed. So Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's a congresswoman.
Well, she's a delegate from D.C. because they don't have formal representation,
right. I always forget
it's that. It's ridiculous.
You know, online, just one last thing about this guy. There's a picture of the family, the mother, father, and the sister, and the son-in-law standing outside the police station with signs. It has been 37 days since you shot our Bijan. All we want for Christmas is who shot him and why. And making the point, obviously, that they're not getting much cooperation about what went on. It's really heartbreaking.
But mention what Norton is doing there, Andrea.
She's filed a bill to make body cameras mandatory mm-hmm. for not just the park police, but all of the, I think, the federal police agencies that protect the property in the district. So that'd be the Capitol Police, the Federal Protective Service. I don't know if the Amtrak police will be involved, but I think she would like to see them all outfitted with body cameras. And her point is, you know, she made the point in writing, I think, and orally, there are surveillance cameras on all of the buildings surrounding all this government property. Why don't we have them on the police officers so that we get an up-close and personal account of what they're encountering and how they're behaving when they're responding to calls?
We're talking to Andrew Curbelo. Andrew, we only have a minute or so left. Do you know what the banana trick is?
Yeah.
Tell people what it is, please.
I don't know from personal experience.
Yeah, so you say. What is it?
You know something? I have to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
If I am a person who will use the self-checkout, it's usually preferable to me to use the self-checkout. Mm-hmm. It has never occurred to me to steal stuff. It just didn't occur to me. And I read this, and I thought to myself, I read the story, which is the banana trick is, you know, you're at the self-checkout, you purchase something that has one price on it, but you, through a number of different ways, you either replace the barcode scanner with something that is cheaper,
mm-hmm.
or you weigh it and say it's produce when it's a T-bone steak or something like that.
Listen to her laughter.
And so you pay for like a bunch of bananas. Well, it is kind of funny.
So wait a second. It never occurred to you, you never had the impulse to stick it to the man at the self-checkout thing, and you said they really charged me too much for butter today, so I am going to compensate for it by employing the banana trick. That never occurred to you?
No, it never occurred to me. Yeah, I know. It wouldn't surprise me if he's like walking through. He probably goes to the 10 items or less line.
Maybe
like
I do.
500 items.
He steals from the hot bar at Whole Foods.
It's not stealing, it's sampling.
Oh,
but go
sampling,
ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Until I read the post from a Reddit user, which is kind of questionable, possibly in and of itself, but somebody posted on Reddit that there is no reason not to do this because that is simply compensation for the fact that the store is having you do their work
exactly.
for them. They're having you check the stuff out
exactly.
and bag
right.
it. And I had never thought of it in those terms. I really did think of it as convenience, never considering how much time and money and jobs, actually, it saves the store for us to check out our own items. And when I read that in the story, I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe this never occurred to me.
Okay, one last thing. You really mean you've never done it. Is that you want to say that
I
again?
I really haven't.
Okay.
Honestly, I would tell you if I had.
Has it ever occurred to you?
No, no, it really hasn't. Oh, I know, I go in, I know what I want to purchase. I go in fully prepared to buy whatever it is that I'm going to buy, and I just pay for it.
Yeah, not everyone is
so
a kleptomaniac.
Not a kleptomaniac.
Okay. Andrew Cabral.
By the way, let me just say, they say in this piece in The Atlantic, rather than walk into a store intending to take something, steal something, a shopper might at the end of a trip decide that a discount is in order. That I think that is not a criminal behavior.
It's a bargain hunter's behavior.
Maybe that's what it is. I would consider.
But in fairness, I will say this in fairness.
Yeah.
People often find out that they're being charged more at the register than the price that they understand the item to be. And supermarkets make millions off of those, you know, nickel errors and dime errors and sometimes more of that. And until you bring it to their attention, they don't recognize or understand the difference between what's on the barcode and what they've listed as the price for the item.
You know what what the antidote to that behavior is? Mm-hmm. The banana trick. That's what it is.
Okay,
Andrea, it's great
Cabral.
To talk to you as always.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Andrea Cabral joins us every week. She's the former Secretary of Education and former Sheriff of Suffolk County.
Secretary of Public Safety,
Public
too.
Safety, sorry. What did I say?
Secretary of Education. Secretary of Education is actually coming in
about 20
minutes.
Oh, he's coming in a few minutes. That's right. But between then and now, we are opening up the lines and asking you about the self-checkout thievery. Are you a kleptomaniac like Jim, who's frequently game the system? Or are you an honest John and Jane and would never dream of stealing at the self-checkout line? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral about the self-scanning scam. Now, in real-life terms, they call it self-checkout thievery. In the world of loss prevention expertise, the name they use is external shrinkage. We're opening up the lines asking if you've ever been complicit in external shrinkage. Andrew Cabral said no. Marjorie has not said anything. I assume that means she has. 877-301.
Why don't you fess up right now?
8970. Have you ever done
Clearly, you have a record in this regard.
I know a lot about this. Have you ever done the pass around, for example? That's where you take an item off the conveyor belt and bag it after you've paid up. Do you know that one, by the way?
No, I do not.
Well, neither do I. Have you manipulated the market? For example, you go to the coffee bean dispenser and fill up a bag of, let's say, organic Peruvian dark roast beans, which costs $18 a pound. But instead, you mark the back with a code for an inferior coffee that really... By the way, you don't need to have done this. I know Willie Mays was the greatest center fielder ever. I'm not a center fielder.
Okay.
So I know. It doesn't mean I did anything. 877-301-897. What liberties have you taken at the grocery store, if any? And if you want to call in and say what Andrea attempted to say, that she's never done it, that's perfectly fine. 877-301-8970. Look at me, please, because you don't look at me when you're telling us.
Have I stolen?
It's not stealing. It's external shrinkage.
Stealing.
Have you ever engaged in external shrinkage?
I have not.
You've never done that.
No, I have not, Jim.
Okay, so if you're aggravated about one price where they clearly are overcharging you at the supermarket, you don't decide to compensate at the self-checkout.
No, I don't. No, I do not. However, the story does say that 20% of people have admitted
to stealing. Is that amazing?
Yeah, and more than half said they gamed the system because detection by store security was very unlikely. In other words, they thought they could get away with it.
Oh, by the way, that's not why. Assuming if I had done it, which I have not, it is a compensatory behavior. It is basically saying they're sticking it to you. And so you do a compensatory stick it to them.
Okay, so you buy the ribeye, but you pretend it's bananas.
One buys the ribeye. Mm-hmm. First of all, let me say right here, because I have never done that.
You've never done that?
I've never done that.
Okay, well, you know, every time I go somewhere and somebody tells me that they met you, and I say,
at the Whole Foods, I know.
Was he at the hot bar? And they always say the same thing, that Jim was standing by the hot bar eating the food out of the hot
By the way, when you say tell those stories, in all seriousness, you're a writer. And by the way, you know, I was just Googling something during the break. And you know what comes up? I have no idea why.
The Daily Mail.
The story you wrote in the Globe about cheerleaders being underpaid is about 10 times as long in the Daily Mail about you writing the story, not only with a beautiful picture of you, a picture of Treni Kuznarek, who's now in South Korea, who you quote in the story.
She gave me the best quote for the whole story.
It's just unbelievable. In any case, we want to know if you've ever engaged.
Jim is saying that because he's upset that his story isn't in the Daily Mail.
Maybe I am. Maybe it is. I haven't searched for that. So we want to know if you've engaged in this behavior. If you have, what has your rationale been? Marjorie says she hasn't. And if you don't, do you do it just because you're honest?
By the
because
way,
it never occurred to you, like Andrea Cabral?
80% of people don't do this,
No,
Jim.
Excuse me.
You were in the small
Marjorie,
20%
for
of
someone as smart as you,
maniacs.
Read what did you just say about the 20%? 20% say
right.
they have stolen.
Okay.
How about the 80% who have not said it? So you assume that all of them are honest? I would assume that a significant chunk just don't want to admit it.
In this one study, there was evidence of widespread theft. After auditing 1 million self-checkout transactions over the course of a year, totaling $21 million, they found that $850,000 worth of that $21 million had been stolen. Hmm.
So let me just say one thing. You have to be careful about the weighing thing, by the way, though, because the thing where the bag is when you check out, you can't just, like a lot of people think, you can just take the item and move it right from the conveyor belt into the bag.
You can't.
There's a weighing thing.
You know, pretend it's a box of Kleenex when it's a T-bone steak.
Exactly.
Yeah, you got to be careful about that.
And I condemn all people who do that. I want to make that totally clear. I'm just saying I know a little bit about it, and obviously Marjorie chooses to pretend that she does.
A cheerleader story.
Yeah,
like
there it is. Daily Mail.
Daily
huge
Mail.
Newspaper in the Great Britain. Anne in the Car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, and thanks for calling. Hi.
They say we host a morning show. They had it wrong.
And they had you writing for the Herald, too. Yeah. They got that wrong, too. But other than that, it was very precise. I'm sorry, Anne. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Okay, no, that's all right. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I actually was kind of surprised. Well, one, I think it's very easy to do. They generally have 5 or 6 cashier stations and only one person supervising, who generally gets called to do something else someplace else if the cashier has a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm kind of surprised Andrea didn't think that it was taking away jobs. That's why I don't do it. I don't use the self-checkout anywhere, whether it's CVS or Stop and Shop or Walmart. I think it's taking away somebody's job, and I just
Well, Kai, by the way, you say you think. I don't think there's about thinking. It is. It does, by definition. And we've had that discussion a lot of times.
Although you do
notice.
And I
think both of us happen to agree with you, do we not?
We do. But I have noticed, Anne, because I shop at CVS a lot. I spend a lot of my life in CVS,
That's
more
nice.
Than I really should, actually. But in any case, that when I go to the self-checkout at CVS, the thing almost always goes off.
And you
there's
need
always
a person.
Some mistake. You haven't.
So you need somebody to help.
Yes, and there's always that same lovely lady who stands there all night long waiting for people to make
but
mistakes.
But that happens at Home Depot too. That's not much of a defense, though.
No, it's not.
Anne's position
it is
a good position.
Jobs.
It is an anti-worker kind of position. Anne, that's an excellent point, and we're glad you made it. But before you go away, if you ever happened to shed your concern for the worker, would you engage in external shrinkage at the self-checkout?
No, to be honest with you, because it's never occurred to me.
Oh.
Never occurred to me.
Neither you nor Andrea.
I just want to get out of there.
Yeah, I got it. Okay, Anne, you and obviously Andrea and I are honest people.
You have to understand that this is coming from a man who used to work at the Woo Woo supermarket
Wawa,
in Philadelphia.
Wawa. Rob on Twitter mentioned that before.
Yeah, he used to work at the Wawa supermarket, and they were coming in to give lie detector tests to the employees because there was some external shrinkage going on at the Woo Woo supermarket.
That is correct, Wawa.
Jim,
I was the assistant manager on the Penn campus.
Just coincidentally quit the day before the lie detector test.
Well, that factually is true. But as always, you only tell half the story.
The
reason
the other
half? Quit the day before is the regional manager says there's a lot of external shrinkage. There's a lot of stealing going on here. We're gonna do a lie detector test on the employees. And I said, fine. And then I didn't say fine, actually, as you'll hear. They said that we want to do one on you, too.
Uh-huh.
And I said, as a matter of principle, that I didn't think the workers should be lie detected. So I quit in
he
protest
quit.
In
That's
support
right.
of the workers.
And he relocated to South Carolina.
By the way, it was a block away from my apartment in West Philly. It was on Penn campus.
Yeah.
I rose to assistant manager quickly.
And the fact that
I had to quit.
Meteoric rise.
Out of principle.
You did.
The Wawa supermarket. And there was a
Thank
lot of thievery
God
going
they
on.
They didn't come back to your house.
I don't know if they ever caught.
Perp walked down Broad Street
in
the cuffs. By the way, I've been watching the Super Bowl parade for Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Kind of a paltry crowd.
No, it depends. No, it's a long thing. There are going to be millions of people. And if
really?
You look, it's
in
ending.
Boston, it's
ending.
Like the duck parade in Boston. Are they doing
ending,
the duck parade there?
I don't know. It's ending a block from where I grew up in Center City, the Art
right.
Museum, a block.
Which means it's also not far from the Woo Woo supermarket.
No, first of all, it's, It's Wawa, and the Wawa was not where I grew up. The Wawa was at the Penn campus where I went to college.
Okay.
And I did not steal anything, and I didn't quit because I was worried about implicating myself. I quit because I didn't want...
He's a man of principle.
Something. Let's go to Sheila in Rhode Island. Sheila, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about what they call the banana trick, which apparently is prevalent in checkout lines at supermarkets. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I honestly, I love you guys.
Thanks.
I can be enlightened and entertained simultaneously,
Thank
so
you.
It's pretty great. But
great.
Honestly, that thought never occurred to me.
Yeah.
And I think that your sort of pattern of external shrinkage, Jim, is a little concerning. Like,
it is.
Where do you draw the line between, you know, being contributing to external shrinkage versus being a thief? I mean, where do you draw the line?
But wait a second, Sheila, if I can, I want to reiterate what I said before. I know I grew up watching a lot of baseball. I know a lot about baseball. I was a horrible baseball player. You don't have to be a great baseball player to understand the game. You don't have to be a thief to understand the banana trick or the pass around, as we call it. Would you not agree with that?
Well, there's a difference between stealing a base in baseball and then, you know, stealing something from a grocery store.
So are you suggesting that you don't believe me when I say I did not steal anything from the grocery store? Is that what you're saying?
You.
Okay.
I think you're a thief.
He's a thief.
She thinks I'm a thief.
You are a thief.
I'm not a thief.
Jim, how many times do I go out in the hallway to get a cup of coffee and I come back here and you've eaten my whole breakfast?
Wait a second. That's the same as stealing from a supermarket? That I do. That I do.
By the way,
there's a solution.
Marjorie, can I eat your muffin? No, I come back.
Excuse me.
It's like a little mouse.
By the way, so Sheila, you and Sheila.
Of my muffin
okay.
is gone.
I want to speak here. You and Sheila are attacking me based on nothing. And if I may respond to your most recent attack, which, and there is some truth to that. I occasionally will eat your breakfast when you leave the room. There's a simple solution, if I may say, and then we'll move on. Don't leave the room.
Okay.
And then I won't eat
your
breakfast.
Now, Maria has
Sheila, that's a scurrilous attack. You'll hear from my lawyers in the morning. Thank you.
Maria's on your side, Jim. I want you to know.
Say?
Not everyone's against you.
What'd
she
say?
She says, I admit it, I'm not proud, but I have scanned broccoli crowns as regular broccoli.
I've done
they
that.
No
By the
longer
way, that
give
I will
customers
admit,
the reusable bag discounts,
that.
And I draw the line at broccoli crowns. However, Maria adds, sampling, which Jim is famous for at the Whole Foods in Cambridge, is just wrong.
You added that. She didn't say
no,
that.
No, she says it right here. Sampling
By the way,
is just
excuse
wrong.
Me. I do sample, yep. and that's a proper verb. If you go to the deli, ever go on the deli counter at Whole Foods?
Yes, I
okay.
have.
Okay, and when you order a quarter pound or something, what do they do? Almost always.
With you, I'm sure they say, would you like
would you like to eat the whole thing here is what they say. Do you want it to go?
That's right. They know what they're dealing with, and they say, just hand it over, and I'll eat it. They try to weigh it first, and then you just take it away.
Can I tell you what I do when I do sample, and that is the appropriate verb. It is not stealing. At the hot bar or the cold bar, the salad bar, depending, is I do it really openly so that if any employee has a problem with it, they can say to you, please don't eat the stuff at the hot bar or the salad bar. And they don't do it, so I assume it's perfectly fine. And by the way, when I sample something, if I like it, I'll buy a lot of
it. Do you put it in a dish? Do you bring your own spoon and fork?
No, I usually carry a roll of aluminum foil with me just in case of emergencies.
Okay.
So I have it just... Not always, but
okay.
most of the time.
Let's go to Melissa in Walpole. Hi, Melissa.
No, we're not supposed to go there.
We're not?
By the way, it's nothing personal. We're
no.
supposed to. Oh,
yes,
we can. Melissa,
we can.
I'm sorry,
we
Melissa.
Can.
Hi.
Okay, it's red and blue. She's blue.
Hi.
Okay, Melissa.
Hi, Melissa. Welcome. Sorry.
Yes, it is me, but please don't say where I'm from because I'm in the Stop and Shop now.
You're in Walpole. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, you up to no good?
You're going to be doing time in Walpole in a second. Go ahead. Go ahead,
All
Melissa.
Right, Right. Until you guys said that there was a name for it,
yeah.
I had no idea. But I had never thought to do that, which is surprising because I could be a kleptomaniac like you, Jim. But
thank you for that.
I have done it by mistake.
Oh, yeah, by mistake. That's what they all say.
Well, kind of, because, you know, like I was getting a Macoun apple, which was more expensive than a Macintosh apple.
Sure.
And the thing was, like, not counting or whatever. You know how it always goes bad on you?
Yeah.
You have to get smoke and fix it. So I just put in, you know, Macintosh. It was cheaper. And so I did it. I am guilty.
Melissa,
do you
can
feel
I tell
bad
you something?
About this, Melissa?
Obviously not.
Do you feel compelled to go back and give them the penny difference at the cash register?
No, you don't understand. Right now I'm in the Stop and Shop.
Oh, you are.
Oh, you're stealing right now.
I'm going. Yes, I'm shopping. That's really and horrible. I need Jim to tell me how it is you can switch.
Well, I am going to tell you actually. First of all, I have the bad news, then I'll give you some advice. The bad news is story is vaguely reminiscent of how Bernie Madoff started. So just keep that in mind. Melissa, and what you do,
got a lot more excuses than me, Jim.
Okay, I want to explain this
to you,
Melissa.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Bernie Madoff.
Can I explain this to her?
Because Jim looks an awful lot like him.
Oh, that's really nice. Thank you very much.
A taller version.
Thank you. Now, Melissa, I don't have any more time for you, but here it is right now. What you do is you, I'm not advising this, but this is what someone might do if they wanted to do the banana trick. Do you know how you, like if you have broccoli and it doesn't have like a scanning thing on it? On the little screen, you look it up and you type in the PLU or whatever it is, the number there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what some people who have malevolent intent might do is they might type in the code for a more expensive thing and then weigh the thing at the lower price.
That's right.
What some people, not I, might do, Melissa, okay?
Not Jim. Of course not.
Melissa is the first honest woman we've had call the show all day today. Melissa, thank you. Good luck to you.
That she's right there in the supermarket contemplating.
Ready to steal as we speak.
She's approaching the near occasion of sin, as they say.
Let us know. Email us at bprwgbh.org after the show, Melissa, and let us know how it went. We'll read it tomorrow. Thank you.
Linda from Seekonk, are you a kleptomaniac as well?
Hi.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, good.
It's first step to the cure.
Give us the details.
Please.
Okay. First of all, I adore you both.
Thank
you. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
I feel like I'm in a confessional box right now.
That's fine.
I'm going to bare my soul.
Good.
Okay. I go to Whole Foods, and I love coffee, and I have switched the codes with the coffee beans that you serve yourself. The thing is, I don't go for the most expensive. I kind of go, like, you know, $2 or $3 more than I can spend, and I'm nervous. And I feel guilty, but once I get home, I'm fine.
Okay, now, don't go away, Linda, because Marjorie, who's posing here, is Miss Purity. Do you have a problem with that? Linda does not go for the $22 a pound kind.
Uh-huh.
She is, let's say, picking the $12 coffee, and she types it in as the $9 coffee. Is that so bad?
I have some ethics.
She has some ethics.
So tell Linda how you feel.
I don't want to criticize anybody, but you know, I like my job here. You know what I mean? I just don't want to be arrested.
No, we're not asking you to do it. Do you think Linda's done anything so horrible?
Well, she's not totally on the up and up. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not totally on the up and up, so you have to be careful and you have to think about these things.
Linda, as long as you don't pick the top price, it's acceptable. Good luck to you, and thank you very much.
Okay.
Bless you.
Okay,
thank
we
you.
Have a lot of thieves that listen to us.
What
Dana says,
I
yes,
sure
I
so.
Absolutely do this. The cost of greeting cards is out of control.
By the way, in all seriousness, if you had to pick 10 items in America generically that are so outrageously priced, will you not say greeting cards are right there?
She doesn't have to worry about it because she says they don't register on the scale at self-checkout.
Just take
Why
them.
Should I pay for them?
It's the old banana trick
with the
Hallmark
trick.
Cards.
So there you go.
Who else?
Who's the person that just said that they never, when they buy organic and they never pay for the organic. They just say it's the non-organic and they sneak that right
it's
through.
Horrible.
Yeah. So there's quite a few of them out there that are thieving. This Tom says his dad regularly lies to checkout workers if they ask what a piece of produce is.
Well, how would they not know what the produce is?
He does it deadpan and it always works well because you wouldn't know if it was the organic or the non-organic and what sort of apple is it.
Well, it has a little sticker on it.
Well, I guess they just...
Well, see, coffee is... Was it Linda who just said coffee is ripe for, what do they call it, external shrinkage?
For external shrinkage,
because
that's
the bags generally are not see-through. And even if they were, how does anybody know what particular bean you have chosen? Again, I want to be clear here so we don't get angry things to our bosses. I am not... Not only am I not advising this, I am not condoning the behavior of some of our listeners and callers.
People are very upset that they're listening to a thief here on the radio from 11 to 2.
Did you ever cheat on your taxes, Marjorie?
Of course not.
Did you ever cheat on your taxes?
I think the year that you did them for
me.
It's
6 years.
That was the year. That was the year that they hauled me in.
It's a six-year statute of limitation.
They were very suspicious.
You've never even thought about taking an extra deduction that you... I'm not, again, I'm just trying to look into your soul.
Have you cheated on your taxes?
Never.
Never.
I would never, ever
never,
do
ever,
that.
Ever, ever,
ever.
Okay. All right.
It's wrong.
I think it is interesting that the year that
totally
you helped me with
wrong.
My taxes is the year I got in trouble.
She got all...
That was the year I got in trouble. I said, you know, he told me this was fine. And then I found out later that indeed.
I also told you if I was you, I wouldn't have done it. Remember that? David Marlborough, you're going to end this right here on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi. Yeah, it's Steve. Yeah, this is a great conversation.
Oh, sorry, Steve.
That's okay. I'm really enjoying it. I'm one of those who don't cross the line. You know, if I end up in the self checkout, I do it all by the numbers.
So do I.
I do everything proper. So, I am surprised to hear about. Go ahead.
Aren't you appalled that we have a guy over here who's
not a guy? All these callers.
Yeah.
Are
okay.
Thieves.
And many of our callers too. What do you think of this, Dave? This is outrageous. This is why America's going to hell in a handbasket.
How about that, Dave?
I know. I'm mostly surprised at all the callers that are doing it. I am surprised. So
Dave, before you go away, let's be clear. Do you not do it because you're a moral person, or do you not do it because you're worried you're going to get caught?
No, it's a moral thing.
Good
really
for
is.
You.
Yeah.
Great. That's the same thing with me. Dave, thank you very much. I'm glad we ended with one honest person. Dave, thank you for the call.
Yeah. I just have Stephen just told me not to worry. I will not be jailed for these petty crimes.
No, it's serious. But can you imagine being hauled out?
No, I cannot
talk show host.
Imagine. Talk show host
you're in the
arrested.
Marjorie, if you Google Daily Mail.
I'm in the Daily Mail.
With a beautiful
and
picture
so is
of
Trenny.
You and Trenny.
And so is Trenny. Yeah, that was from a couple of years ago at my Christmas party, actually.
Well, the photograph was?
Yes, it was.
You recognize the picture?
I do recognize the picture.
Wow.
Because there's this person next to me that we had to cut out.
Who is it?
Can't tell you. Tell you during the break.
Okay, fine.
Okay. We are moving on. We're moving on.
Marjorie
from this.
Obviously has no idea who's coming next. I can tell when Marjorie says we're moving on, or Jim, are we done with this?
Okay.
It means she has no idea what we're doing next.
I
Want
don't.
Me to give you a hint?
I don't, yes.
He used to be the Secretary of Education.
Oh, former Secretary
God
of Education, Paul Revel, joins us. He's up next. We're going to talk to him about these crackdown on Wellesley College by the Koch brothers and a bunch of other stuff about education. That is next. Paul Revel is with us.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan. A ton of academic leaders are demanding the university, Harvard University's next president, have the conviction to stand up to President Trump. But across the river, did a Northeastern professor take this too far, saying he wouldn't mind if President Trump were dead? Former Secretary of Education Paul Revel joins us for that and other education headlines. Paul is a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. Hey there, Paul Revel. How are you?
Good to be here, Jim and Marjorie.
Great to talk to you, Paul. So what do they mean, stand up to President Trump at Harvard University? What's this about?
Well, I think there's a widespread feeling in higher education these days that the whole institution of higher education, the notion of research, the notion of using evidence to make cases on persistent problems that society solves, and the credibility of the university is being called into question by the Trump administration, by Republicans more generally nationally, and that we need more spokespeople for the sector. And who better than the president of Harvard University, since that university has so much prestige, to be a vocal, forceful spokesperson on that. So I think people are hoping that in this appointment, we'll get somebody like that.
Do you think that you and I have had a discussion on air? I don't want to put you on the spot about Drew Faust-Gilpin, and obviously, in my opinion, has the broadest bully pulpit in the world on the education front about whether or not she's used it enough externally or not. Part of this urging about her successor who is yet to be chosen is internally, is it not? Are there Harvard leaders who are hoping that the next, her successor?
Yeah, I think that's right, which is not to say that she's been deficient in her leadership. I mean, she inherited the presidency at a very turbulent time when you had a strong external spokesperson, kind of president Larry Summers, but there were a lot of problems internally to the university and financial problems, and she needed to be, you know, a steward of the institution, both financially and politically, internally, to manage a number of divisions that had arisen during the Larry Summers presidency. So she, I think, naturally had to focus within and did a good job of stabilizing the university, you know, growing it from a development standpoint, putting an emphasis on some concerns internally about inclusion, about diversity and things of that nature, but maybe not spending as much time as some would have hoped being an external voice for higher education generally. And it may be time where we can afford to have a president who takes some time on that topic.
You know, you always, when you look at American history, there's long been this kind of anti-intellectual streak. You know, remember we used to talk about the Know-Nothing mm-hmm. Party mm-hmm. back way back when. But the consensus is, I assume, that it's worse now.
Yeah, I think it's worse now when you get to things like climate change, for example, and the argument gets down to alternative sets of facts, or even in the absence of facts, that you know, people have cast this debate as simply a matter of opinion or a matter of intuition,
yeah,
rather than a matter to which we bring evidence and we look at patterns and we identify those patterns and through analysis come up with a conviction about what's true and what isn't true. And it isn't a matter of opinion. And so that's being called into question, the basic foundations of the university. Now, in fairness, some of the people who are critical of the university also think, from an ideological standpoint, the universities have tilted way left and are intolerant of a diversity of viewpoints or intolerant of conservative
there's
viewpoints
some truth
and things of that,
that
nature.
Would you not
and
say?
Well, there is truth
yeah,
to that.
No, there's definitely truth for that. Truth to that, and I think
kid goes away to college, comes home at Thanksgiving, he's like a Sandinista,
right? And if you send a kid off to college who happens to have conservative viewpoints, they feel stifled or marginalized or worse. So, I mean, I do think universities have some way to go. You know, we have kind of an obsession with focusing in on diversity and inclusion and things of this nature, which I think are important. But we usually leave off the ideological part of diversity. And I think we need to work harder in our universities at being ideologically more open-minded.
So on the other side of the river, as I said before, is a guy that the two of us have had on, and
yeah.
I've known for decades. Barry Bluestone,
right? I know
who,
Barry.
Was an economist extraordinaire. He's at the Dukakis Center. I think he's quite well respected for good reasons. We had him on recently about. Well, you had him on when I was on vacation.
Yes.
On housing and traffic, and I mean, he's really at the top of his game. But he's at this event, and he's asked the question. I guess this is in January. Question about the future of the United States. Sometimes I want to just see him impeached. This is Barry speaking. Other times, quite honestly, I hope there are no FBI agents here. I wouldn't mind seeing him dead. Mm-hmm. And Northeastern, of course, separates them. So while faculty members are free to express controversial opinions, the university cannot provide a public platform for comments that would be construed to condone violence. I haven't followed this since I first read it last night. What happens to this guy? I'm assuming this becomes the lead story on Fox News. And as a result, we'll get maybe the Drudge report. I haven't seen Drudge today. What should happen to Bluestone? What will happen to Bluestone? Anything?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. That's going to be up to Northeastern and for Northeastern to, you know, take a position on what kinds of speech they're willing to tolerate internally. Barry Bluestone's a consummate professional. I think almost anyone is to be forgiven being sort of driven to distraction these days by some of the things that come out of the executive branch. He's obviously had a moment here, which I would imagine he would like to take back if he had the opportunity to do it. So it's an unfortunate pronouncement. It sets a bad example. I don't think it's the kind of dialogue we want to see. I'd expect Northeastern University to sort of strongly disapprove of this, but I'd be surprised if, given the you know, the scope of academic freedom, that they're going to go after him individually.
Well, let me just say, he is not exactly contrite. Here's part of what he says. This is Campus Reform, which is a conservative news website that's quoted in Mass Live. In my opinion, Trump is the most dangerous man on the planet. It's Barry Bluestone speaking. Because of his power using lies and half-truths to galvanize his supporters and his ability to command vast military resources, would I kill him? No. And I normally abhor violence in all forms. So I don't know if that's exactly an apology. I think it's a clarification, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like an apology. I think it's an explanation for why he thinks he's dangerous, thinks he's a threat, and would prefer if he weren't around, I guess, is kind of what he's saying. But the nature of the language, it's just not helpful. It contributes to an atmosphere that's tolerant of violence, that is simplistic in the way we solve problems, and it's not the way Barry proceeds to organize his professional life.
It is a mistake, but I certainly don't think someone should be, as Emily Rooney likes to say, ridden out of town on a rail.
I agree, but you know what's important here? And by the way, I've known Barry for decades, and I'm a huge admirer of him personally
Me
and
too.
His work. However, if in a circumstance like this, and he's to the left, clearly, if some right-winger had said the exact same thing about Barack Obama 4 years ago, I think I wouldn't mind seeing him dead.
Yeah.
I think there'd be condemnation, at least of the remarks, if not the person, by liberal America. And I think in a situation like this, you can like and respect the speaker, but say you are not happy with the speech. You know?
No, yeah. Absolutely. I don't think anybody can condemn that kind of language.
Yeah, and I don't think he's probably very happy with the speech at this point, too, although it's not a very strong apology. He just can't say something like that. Okay. But on the other hand, having made many mistakes myself, being on live radio, I am not I'm not keen on throwing anybody out the door.
I'm not suggesting be thrown under the bus. I'm talking about how we all should react to something like this.
No, it's a
significant mistake,
should be condemned, but at the same time, somebody shouldn't lose their job
over
this. We should move on. He's going to pay the price for it.
So you did a great piece on your show about recess.
Oh, we're doing that next? Okay,
no,
fine.
I'm
we can.
No, we're not going to do that next.
Well, we can, yeah. And actually, I asked the reporter, Stephanie Lydon, about your position, because I think Bianca, one of our colleagues, spoke to you about this thing. Yeah. A state rep, Marjorie Decker from Cambridge, has filed a bill making recess mandatory in schools in Massachusetts. There's some blowback, particularly from I think it's the Association of Superintendents and some others who don't like mandates. I think everybody is saying recess is an important thing. It just, they don't like mandates. What is the state of recess, which I happen to think is hugely important? I'm curious to know what you think. What's the state of recess in public schools in Massachusetts, and what should it be, and is the law necessary or appropriate?
Well, this, I think, is a classic example of the kind of false dichotomies we get into in education sometimes. You're either in favor of recess or opposed to recess. And as you point out, I don't know anybody who's really opposed to recess, opposed to the idea that kids need to break up the day, they need to get out, they need to exercise physically. We have all kinds of physiological evidence to suggest this is not only better for kids physiologically, it's better for them in terms of learning and concentration and so on and so forth.
And to develop social skills, is it not?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And the things that happened during that period of time. So everybody's in favor of recess. The state, I don't know the exact numbers, Jim, but I mean, over time, there has been a narrowing of recess as we have pushed harder for schools to achieve ever higher standards in academics, and we haven't created more time for schools to do that. We have said to schools, get to world-class standards and achieve them for everybody in the same amount of time we used to give you to achieve world-class standards with just a few kids. And naturally, they've started taking time from other subjects to add time in those measured areas. So English and math are big winners at the expense of the arts and recess. And my argument is we shouldn't get into a battle. Are arts more important than English? You know, is recess more important than math? We should have more time in the school day to do all those things that children need in order to be well-educated and ready for success.
So where would you be if you were the Secretary of Education on this bill?
In this particular bill, I'd be in favor of it in the sense that I think it tells people you can't retreat in this mm-hmm. particular area. But I'm with the superintendents in the sense that, you know, if we get to mandating everything like this, we're treating the symptoms, we're not treating the problem. I would more, as a Secretary of Education, like to say we should be looking on what it takes to expand the school day and make sufficient time so that we can have the arts, so that we can have history, so that we can have all the electives that students like to take in high school, and at the same time do math and English and science, and at the same time give students time to stand up and stretch and move around, play games with their peers and so forth, and have a healthy day.
We're talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education in Massachusetts.
So we just mentioned a couple of minutes ago that a lot of college campuses lean very left in what the professors teach, and that's the perspective you get at too many of these schools. The Koch brothers spending a lot of money on colleges around the country. The Globe had a piece about how they're trying to get more conservative scholarship at Wellesley College, and two young women apparently from Wellesley get up at some event. They had their winter retreat, so-called, and talked about how their ideas, conservative and libertarian, were unwelcome at the Wellesley campus. I mean, again, I guess it depends on what you're trying to do, but it is a point. I mean, I can
It's totally a point, and I think it's legitimate for you know, people and for donors to say we have an interest in creating a more diverse ideological climate at some of these schools, and I think it's up to the institutions themselves to control how far you let donors dictate what you do at a university. I don't think any donor should be dictating who you hire as a professor. That is part of academic integrity. That should be reserved to the faculty and to the institution to hire who they want. But the idea that you'd put some money about that would enable there to be clubs and organizations who are committed to bringing in points of view that are at variance with the sort of common orthodoxy at these institutions. I basically think that's a good idea. I know that a number of liberals react in shock and horror to that, but I think our students need to be able to tolerate that kind of diversity,
because
that's
sides.
The world outside.
Well, I also wonder how. Is this new? I mean, is this like a post-1960s kind of thing? Did universities used to be so left-leaning in the 40s and 50s?
No, I think it's become more pronounced since the 60s, and I'm not sure exactly why, but, that trend from the 60s forward and the designation, you know, by sort of outside groups looking at what's going on in the universities and being concerned that these were left-leaning institutions, which tended to be hothouses and not tolerant of other ideas, I think it's been around and has been a critique since the late 60s, early 70s.
You know, getting back to I don't know anything about this Wellesley thing except what I read. Was it Annie Linsky who wrote the piece in the Boston Globe? I think, and I'm obviously Paul, diversity of ideas is a wonderful thing. Dictates from donors is not a wonderful thing. We should say, in the spirit of disclosure, one of the Koch brothers, David Koch, has been a trustee here at GBH for 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. And positions that the Koch brothers have taken on issues, some environmental issues, are not at all what places like Nova do.
No, I
and
know.
And so while we've been here some days when there's been picketing
or
outside
frontline.
About it, exactly, the point is it clearly, at least I don't work on those shows or in that pieces of the operation. It surely has not affected editorial policy at places, as you say, like Frontline and Nova and things like that. So the hope is that it will be no different at Wellesley.
I just think we've got to be more sophisticated and should be in universities and not label somebody like the Koch brothers as a persona non grata just out of hand because on two or three important issues, we differ significantly from where they're coming from. Therefore, we should condemn their viewpoint on every issue. It's more complicated than that.
Jeff Riley is now the Commissioner of Education, correct?
I think it's a great choice.
Well, you've probably read, and Jeff Riley, by the way, we've spoken about Jeff Riley. He took over the Lawrence schools. Charlie Baker, I think I'm 99% sure about this, on our show, has raved about what he's done in the Lawrence schools. But there's been criticism of the selection by at least two high-profile women in the pages of the Boston Globe. Shirley Leung was concerned, both because of the issue that there were two women, one of color, who applied, who appeared to be qualified, and Kathy Minahan, who used to be head of the Fed here, with a colleague, and I can't remember the other woman's
Vanessa
name.
Vanessa Calderon.
Wrote a piece, was it in Today's?
Today's,
in
today's,
yes, Boston, today's Globe, Boston Globe.
Where I think Shirley was much more complimentary of Riley's credentials, but saying, you know, we have an all-white infrastructure in education here. The commissioners are all white. The secretary is white. The head of UMass, Marty Meehan, is white. Today, my quick reading of the Minahan piece seems to be that maybe he's not the star. But whether he is or not, are you concerned about the issues they raise vis-a-vis the face of public education in Massachusetts vis-a-vis race and gender?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've taken a few steps backward. It used to be at the university level that we had many more women presidents of universities. We have very few, if any, right at
the
moment.
We have none now, I think. Yeah. I think it's zero for none, at least according to Shirley. I think so.
We've been going backwards. We used to have at least one female commissioner in my era, and now we have none. So, I mean, I feel like it's legitimate to criticize that pattern and legitimate to make this maybe the straw that breaks the camel's back and really push as far as things go in the future. I don't think there's much of a case to be made that Jeff Riley wasn't the most qualified candidate in this recent search. I mean, I think he had very strong credentials, a proven track record here in Massachusetts, and is coming at just the set of issues that I think the Commonwealth needs to be addressing. So I find it hard to get traction on a case that says Riley isn't the best guy for the job. But I do think there's a real issue in terms of not having enough female leadership in education, and we ought to do something about that. And those who are running searches right now need to be mindful of it, and I think they are. I mean, the next big one is the Chancellor of the University of Massachusetts Boston.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's do we have time for the one more thing?
Quickly.
There was a really disturbing story about Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Total shenanigans that the piece argues is because of pressure to perform. What's going on there?
Well, you know, there have been a couple of waves. One several years ago that was looking at some of the improved test scores that happened in a lot of Washington schools under Michelle Rhee's leadership. You remember Michelle Rhee was an outspoken hero of the more conservative education reform movement, who was pictured on the front of Time magazine with a broom sweeping out unqualified teachers. So was a highly controversial figure. During her tenure, after her tenure, some test scores went up substantially, and she, of course, took credit for it. And then there was a wave of findings that suggested many of those scores were artificially inflated, and there'd been some cheating. And I don't know that they ever got to the bottom of that whole thing, but that was problem A. Problem B has just arisen, where a city audit in Washington, D.C. has discovered that the graduation rates in current high schools are dramatically inflated. They're graduating large numbers of people who haven't met the most basic requirements for graduation and boasting about an improved graduation rate. And this points to a problem. Now, obviously, it's a problem. There's cheating going on. A standard has been imposed, and people are finding ways to get around it. I'm not one who believes, and I've been asked, I had a call from the Washington Post just the other day about this very issue, should we vacate the standard because people are cheating? I feel like that's a bit like saying, because people run traffic lights, should we no longer have any traffic regulation or traffic lights?
Or because people steal the checkout should we shut down the supermarkets?
Right. But you're not charging anybody anything.
Exactly.
But you're not saying that you shouldn't examine whether the standards are the right standards, correct?
No, that's right. And I think, you know, a high school graduation standard was an effort to move away from pure test scores and say, okay, here's a different standard we can look at. So that standard was added, you know, to the federal accountability system, you know, over the course of the past 10 years. And now we find that at least one significant district, and this has happened before in other districts, like the School District of Atlanta, Georgia, had a major cheating scandal. And it's been a problem. So I think we should set high standards. If they're so high that we find cheating is the norm rather than the exception, then we should probably back off and have another look at that standard. But if we recognize that human beings, if they're put under performance pressure in virtually any sector, whether it's religion or government or education, a few will find a way to cheat to get around that pressure. That's true in education, and we oughtn't to abandon having standards just because that's
the case. But let's be clear, at least from my reading of this Washington story, these were not just outliers. These were just not just on the margins. Is that?
No, it appears to have been widespread in the high schools there. Okay. And so that's a problem. It's a problem that they need to look at, you know, in terms of top leadership, where were they on this? In terms of school leadership, where were they? And how is this translating down? So it's a problem.
Paul, it's good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Do you ever say that the broccoli is, or they're not broccoli crowns, but real broccoli, try to sneak that through in the...
I have not tried that, but you've been planting ideas,
let me know how
diabolical
goes,
ideas.
Call me tonight,
tempting us to go across the border here.
Thank you very much. Former Secretary of Education Paul Revel joins us regularly. He's a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. Thank you, Paul. Coming up, for decades, Daniel Ellsberg was the public face of the Pentagon Papers, but the leak had many more people operating behind the scenes, and something called the Lavender Hill Mob was involved there, too, and one of those members is coming out of hiding. We'll talk to him next. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Back to Boston Public Radio.
Well, thank you, Marjorie. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Steven Spielberg's latest movie dramatizes the Washington Post decision to publish the classified Pentagon Papers, a decision that exposed government lies about the Vietnam War.
Let's do our jobs. Find those pages.
You're talking about exposing years of government secrets.
Is that legal?
What is it you think we do here for a living, kid?
Ben, I might have something.
It must be precious cargo.
Just government secrets.
about those government secrets. For nearly 50 years, Daniel Ellsberg has been the public face of the Pentagon Papers. But the New Yorker has discovered there was an entire syndicate behind the leaks. Ellsberg called them the Lavender Hill Mob, and one of the so-called mobsters was named Mr. Boston. Ellsberg told the New Yorker that Mr. Boston took care of all the cloak and dagger stuff. Well, now Mr. Boston has come out of hiding. His real name is Gal Alperovitz. He's an historian and political economist. His latest book is Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. Gar, it is great to meet you. It's a fabulous story. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So, tell us, why did you wait so long to reveal this incredible story?
Well, there was no point really in revealing the story. What happened was as you know, the movie came out and began to bring attention back to the subject. And so it seemed an important time when we could renew interest in the question that Dan Ellsberg, of course, has made famous, his choices. So I thought, well, now might be a time to talk about this again and bring it into public discourse.
Was there any, before we get into the story itself, which is spectacular, I should say, and I assume most people, well, I'm not most people, nobody knew about it except insiders. Was there ever a temptation? I mean, you were a major part of a huge part of American history. There was never a temptation, Gar, to say it wasn't just Ellsberg, it was me and some graduate students and other committed Americans who cared about getting out the truth. That never motivated you at all?
You know, to tell the truth, it did not. I thought Dan was the main figure. He had taken the major risks. We tried to help out at the last moment in the distribution strategies. I think that's where we made some kind of a contribution. That wasn't something that I felt was something I wanted to or needed any publicity about. And I thought Dan was the main figure by far.
So we read that you, I think it's fair to say, met Daniel Ellsberg by chance. I think it was a dinner. You didn't know much of each other. Take the story from there. How did you get more deeply involved as part of this Lavender Hill mob thing there, Gar?
Well, I think the thing to know first is that I had worked in the House, the Senate, and in the State Department at a very high level. Mm-hmm. And I had seen what was going on from the inside, including the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was basically the Johnson administration, was a fraudulent memo that was it'd be brought to the attention of the Senate and the Congress, suggesting a major attack, which we could then respond to. And it gave authorization for what became a massive war, killing 3 million people. And it had looked at the outset to me working in the Senate, and then when I was at a very high level of the State Department, as a dishonest approach to kind of driving the American public into what became a war, costing all these lives. So I was very, very, open to questioning the war. A lot of people were dying, as I said, ultimately 3 million people. It's half of a Holocaust. It's an extraordinary thing. 58,000 Americans. That question was always weighing heavily on me at the time as a government insider. And then when I was out of government, I was at the Institute of Politics at Harvard and thereafter set up a small think tank in Cambridge. So I was very open to this. I'd also worked with Martin Luther King Jr., to start a particular campaign, ringing doorbells and petition signing, and I got him up to Cambridge to launch a project on bringing more and more people in neighborhoods and middle-class folks into the anti-war movement at that point. So I was very, myself, worried about what had gone on, and probably I should say I'm a historian, and had studied the use of atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and knew something about some of the kind of cover-up of parts of that. The military, by and large, was against it, and the political figures were for it. So that's the background. And when I met Dan, by chance, someone, friends of ours, had suggested getting together, and he and his wife, Patricia, invited me to dinner. We were on the same wavelength intellectually and politically and concerned about this war that was going on, we felt, without adequate authorization and to no good purpose, ultimately. Obviously, a war we lost. But what his papers showed, what the Pentagon papers showed, this was inside documents that McNamara had ordered studied, they showed that all along major American figures understood that there was really no way to win this war, even as they kept escalating the war and sending more troops both to die and, thousands, millions ultimately, of Vietnamese people. No one wanted to lose the war, even though they thought and understood they couldn't win it. So it was a really major tragedy, as well as a murderous process that more and more people who were involved. And, of course, at that point, the draft was on, so young people in college were on the line to be drafted. So it was a very intense period, and people were, I think, rightly very upset about what the government was doing with in Vietnam, and I was one of them.
We're talking to Gar Alperovitz, who we have just learned, at least I have just learned, helped Daniel Ellsberg get the Pentagon Papers out into the newspapers of America. So he was at the RAND Corporation. This is Ellsberg. He Xeroxed a lot of the secret, top secret stuff. He had
7,000 pages.
Exactly. Thousands and thousands of pages of this material. So what happened? How did the 7,000 pages wind up first in the Washington, I'm not first in the New York Times, and then later in the Washington Post and other newspapers?
Well, I was not involved in giving the papers to the New York Times. Dan arranged that himself, and then there were also other people, I believe, at the Institute for Policy Studies who simultaneously had a role in doing that. But then when they appeared in the New York Times, the Nixon administration shut down further publication. They went and got an injunction to the Times, stopping the Times from further publication. The first time in American history, given that the Constitution guarantees freedom of the press. This had never happened before. So there was a stoppage. And then the question was, what might happen next? And, I was, as I said, I just met Dan and a couple other folks who were friends of his, and they let me know that the papers were available. I didn't know about this. Could I help them, or was I interested in helping them arrange to get them to the newspapers and basically to the public? Not that we were less interested in the newspapers, but that this demanded a public discussion showing that American leaders had systematically, regularly lied about the war and their knowledge that it couldn't be won. So that's the choice I was faced with, and I felt, given all the reasons I just said in my own experience, in the government at fairly high levels, both in the Senate and the State Department, I thought it was really important. People were dying for no reason, and the government was lying about it.
Before you tell us about your visits to various and sundry payphones, I think in Cambridge and Somerville, there, Gar, when you, considering your politics and how you felt about the war as an insider because you work in Congress and beyond in the State Department, when you were first told, I think it was by a graduate student when you were leaving a dinner, if I'm correct, that these papers existed, what was the feeling you had? What did that mean to you?
Well, it was it's surprising because the Pentagon Papers were commissioned and ordered by Robert McNamara, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Defense, and it was his trying to understand how we had gotten into this mess. He understood there was a real problem. So my own feelings was, when I began to look at the papers and saw what they were confirming things that I had seen in the Senate, the very, very dubious evidence that was used to kind of rush people into supporting what was called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, but gave the government the power to do whatever it wanted in Vietnam, dubious evidence. And indeed, when you look back at it, and what the papers also show is that American leaders knew from, starting with the Truman administration, that it was all but impossible, they were supporting the French at that time, to win in Vietnam. So something very tragic was happening. Young men and women were going out to die, and insiders knew that this couldn't be won, and they just didn't want to lose. Didn't want to lose on their watch was, I think, the main thing. They wanted somebody else to take the loss rather than, so they kept the fighting going and the killing going and the dying going.
Okay, Gar, we want a little of the cloak and dagger here, okay? We want this part, too. The Washington Post movie called The Post, it just came out, shows part of what with the payphone business and then Daniel Ellsberg in the hotel room, which I think is not exactly how it went down. But tell us about the Washington Post payphone deal with you and the reporter.
Well, the question was these boxes and boxes.
Boxes and boxes and boxes.
And Dan Ellsberg's real desire was to get this study out into the public.
Right.
And he thought, well, we'll get it all out at once. And, 7,000 pages is more than one newspaper story. So I just urged him, look, we could break it up in chunks and that way would be digestible. We could have the story understood. And secondly, we perhaps could keep the story in the public eye for more than one or two sessions by distributing to various newspapers. So that's what ultimately we decided to do, that strategy. And I suppose that's, if I made any small contribution, it was suggesting that strategy and then helping him implement it.
But weren't you in the hotel room with him, with this, is where these massive numbers of papers were, or am I mistaken about that?
The papers, that's one piece of the story, and I was not involved in the hotel room. That's,
okay.
The Washington Post reporter, a man named Ben Bagdikian, the late Ben Bagdikian, I did help arrange for him to come up to do that, which is one of my jobs in this story, a small job. And then he met, and he was an old friend of Dan's from California and the RAND Corporation. So that Washington Post, I arranged the setup, and then he took the papers back to Washington, and the Washington Post published. And then the government stopped the New York Times from publishing. It got an injunction. Then they stopped the Washington Post. So that was stopped. And then the question was, what next? How could we keep this idea, these ideas and this information out to the public in different newspapers?
So
and
you so go you- to a payphone. You call, I assume, an assignment desk or something. From the way the New Yorker reads, you say, "Hi, I'm Mr. Boston." And I've got what? Could you describe what? And apparently, in every case, a newspaper said, yes, we were interested. What did you communicate to them? What did you say, Gar?
Well, first, you know, it's a tribute to the American press. They wanted to publish knowing they would be shut down. But the government couldn't do all the newspapers in the country. So the ones that had not yet published were just publishing their regular stories. So I would call up, say, the Boston Globe, which I think was number three after the Washington Post.
Love that.
What's that?
We love
she
that.
Said, we love that. Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And Dan in particular, Boston Globe had been very early against the war. They had taken a very strong position, a very, very responsible position. And so I think I called either the assignment desk and got some editor, and I said, I called myself Mr. Boston, and if they wanted some of the papers, we could arrange to do that. And of course, everybody wanted to publish after the New York Times and the Washington Post had been shut down, and the Boston Globe was next. And so then, you know, I was going to these payphones because they were not traceable, and then we arranged one way or another to get them the papers, and that's a whole other story how that was done.
With runners, with graduate students, with like-minded people who shared your and Daniel Ellsberg's views of the war, who are willing to put themselves at risk as well, to get the material to the newspapers to publish. Is that not how it went from phone call to front page?
That's exactly what happened. There were some very concerned graduate students, one or two, who were willing to take the papers, usually in this way, broken down into digestible chunks, a couple hundred pages each, and find a way to basically get them to the papers in one form or another, so they could then publish the story. And then, of course, they were shut down, and then on to the next newspaper.
So tell us about sneaking Walter Cronkite up to Cambridge for an interview.
Well, this was a very big story. I happened upon it because I had dinner with Dan and Patricia Ellsberg, and, you know, the moment arrived, and the question was, can you help? So it's yes or no. I had not been in on any of the earlier part. But as it began to develop, it became, you know, quite a huge national story. And what I'd hoped and what we'd hoped would happen is that we could keep educating the public by going through, I think, ultimately 19 stops and starts.
Yeah.
One newspaper would publish, they would be shut down, and we'd go to another newspaper, and I think it was about 3 weeks in 19 newspapers. So I think the story got out, and it was in the public eye for a long time, and also the information was out in digestible form, and all of those were some of the goals that we, at least I was urging.
So what about Cronkite?
Well, Cronkite, you know, it was clear this was a much bigger national story than most had expected, I suppose. And one Cronkite at that time was, you know, he was the face of truth and honesty.
That's
in America.
Right.
We don't have, you know, the networks are not the way they used to be
no.
at that point. CBS dominated, and Walter Cronkite was watched every night by, I think, a majority of television viewers. And very, very much, you know, when Cronkite turned against the war later,
exactly.
President Johnson said, it's all over now.
That's exactly
because
right.
So many people trust him. Yep. So I just called up CBS, and I called, and I spoke with Cronkite, and I said, this is Mr. Boston. I think he thought I was Dan, but and I said, if you'd like an interview, we can arrange that.
And by the way...
And he had to be snuck into Cambridge. Is that not a fair description? So that Ellsberg's whereabouts would not be...
Because Ellsberg faced serious prison time.
Right.
Yeah, although Dan chose to do what he did, knowing that he would face the rest of his life in prison. He was fully aware of that's what the consequences were, and he was prepared to take that. It's a very, very brave stance.
Were you worried about your own freedom through this? They were looking for any associates or collaborators, as they probably considered them. I think that they thought they might be in Paris or someone, obviously in plain sight. There in Cambridge and related places. Were you worried about your own freedom there, Gar?
You know, looking back on it, I am amazed that I was... I'm not a terrible risk-taker. That's not my style.
Mm-hmm.
I recall being extremely cautious and careful, but I don't recall actually of kind of thinking I was going to jail for the rest of my life at the time, and although probably that was the risk. So I was... very, very much against the war. I'd seen it from the inside, and I was taking risks, but I think probably a little less conscious than I'd like to think I was.
You know, we're talking with Gar Alperovitz, who was involved with helping Daniel Ellsberg get the Pentagon Papers, I should say, his latest book is Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. You know, I saw the movie The Post a few days ago. I liked it. I thought it was a good movie. But it was depressing also because I left, and I'm not a historian, but it seems as though we haven't learned much in terms of lessons from the Pentagon Papers. You're an historian. What do you think?
Well, that's the tragedy. We were running then on what was called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. It was not a declaration of war. It was authorization for using force in the Gulf of Tonkin, which is as part of just offside of Vietnam.
Right.
We are currently operating on another kind of resolution that was with the Iraq War, and it's been continued giving authorization. Now we're in parts of Africa, all over. Never the real intent of this kind of very broad authorization, and we haven't had a. The Constitution says a Congress should declare war if it's going to war, and we haven't gone back to that for a very, very long time. And I think it's a major failing that needs to be thought about and debated and corrected.
You know, Gar, before you go away, I mean, you remember it much better than I, but I remember it quite vividly myself. The debate began, is Ellsberg a traitor? Is he committing treason, or is he a great patriot? And we've heard similar sorts of things about the Edward Snowdens and the Chelsea Mannings in recent time. What's your perspective on their activities?
Well, I think it's people should not be violating government oaths and secret papers except in extreme circumstances. And I think in the cases we've seen, we've learned that the government was doing things that were illegal and dishonest. And in those cases, I think it's important for people to take risks. But I certainly don't believe it's the kind of a pattern that should be everyday practice. But if there are extreme circumstances and large numbers of people who could be killed, as in the case of certainly Vietnam and the Vietnam War and thereafter. Then in the case we had kind of fraudulent getting into the Iraq War, there were no nuclear weapons, and we know that now. Those are the kinds of things when government officials are irresponsible and lying to the public, then people knowing the risks they're taking, and they did know the risks they're taking, people can do that if they stand on principle and then they're willing to go to jail or stay out of the country or whatever it is. But only in rare circumstances. I think normally we should follow the constitutional principles, and I think the government has a responsibility to do that as well. My worry is that the government doesn't always do that.
Gar, thank you so much for your time, your work, et cetera, et cetera. We really appreciate your calling in. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much.
That was the voice of Gar Alperovitz, an historian, political economist.
What a story, by the way.
And he recently told The New Yorker, and it's a great piece, that he helped Daniel Ellsberg leak the Pentagon Papers. Gar's latest book is Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. He's also the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and co-chair of its Next System project. Gar Alpervitz, thank you very much for joining us.
By the way, Eric, I hope I pronounce it, Lichtblau wrote the piece January 29th in The New Yorker, and it is well worth your time.
It's amazing, especially since none of us knew about it. I didn't know about it. I just saw the post-movie and read about the Pentagon Papers. Anyway, coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you if you could keep a secret, maybe not about the Pentagon Papers and national security. This one played a role in history for 50 years. But could you keep any kind of secret for more than 10 minutes and approaching 50 years? That is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we were talking to Gar Alpervitz. And again, read the New Yorker story. It is a major piece of American history, and it's happened right here in our midst over there in Cambridge and Somerville. He was a guy who, you know, people knew his writing and his teaching and his work on history and politics and the economy, but not much more until last week. And then at the age of 81, he decided to tell the New Yorker about his role in leaking the Pentagon Papers. Gar, along with former presidents, people who work in the military community, have had to keep a lot of important information to themselves. We're opening up the lines for the final few minutes here at 877-301-8970. Do you have a similar sort of restraint in your bones? Are you someone who has to tell somebody a secret as soon as the secret is known to you? Is this something you're good at? Or are you known as somebody who can't be trusted, as Marjorie said, to keep any kind of secret of importance for more than a nanosecond? 877-301-8970. You know what the difference is?
What?
This guy, I don't know him. I know of his work. Do you hear how humble he was? Yeah, how many times did he say what a small part I played in this? He played a huge part in an incredibly important moment in recent American history.
This was a huge deal. I mean, as we said before, Ellsberg faced going to jail for life. The government was so determined to nail him, they broke into a psychiatrist's office so they could get nasty stuff about him. This is all
under... Also, as he said, millions of people died because of these lies.
Yes, millions of people died because of these lies. You know, if you haven't seen the movie The Post, I mean, it's gotten mixed reviews, but I thought it was really good. Of course, I'm biased because it's a newspaper story, but I thought it was great and also showed about the courage that it took Catherine Graham and Ben Bradley to publish this. Because the Post was about to go public at this very moment, and a lot of its investors were really nervous. Of course, the New York Times is a little bit upset because the New York Times is the one that actually broke the story, and they kind of lost control of it. But anyway, to be such a important part of American history and willing to stick your neck out for a cause that you could have gotten in huge trouble for. I mean, look at Chelsea Manning. How much time was Chelsea Manning going to be spending in jail initially?
Had she not gotten a pardon from Barack
Obama? 30 years or something like that.
Yeah, but let's take it down to less serious things.
Yeah.
Are you you are the kind of person who intends to keep a secret, but you are, is it fair to say without being, you're a little disorganized? And occasionally,
well, I forget the secret is the problem for me.
Marjorie,
someone tells me
occasionally
a secret.
I've told you a secret, and then you've violated and told me back the secret, not realizing I was the one who you promised
Hold
to
on.
Keep the secret
Hold
secret
on.
To.
You've got this backwards. You were the one that does that. I'm pretty good at keeping secrets, actually.
It was me. It was 877-301-8970. By the way, I am really good at keeping a secret. I am really trustworthy.
Really?
I am really trustworthy. No, if I make a commitment to somebody. But the question is, if it turns out I had done something of that significance, would I be willing to keep it a secret? Would I be willing? I don't want to go to jail either, obviously. But there's a point at which I just don't think I could keep it to myself.
So, Deep Throat from Watergate fame, Mark Felt kept
this
a secret
like
for 30 years that he was the one that gave them all the information. He was
Woodward and Bernstein.
Yes, he was an FBI guy. And he was the second ranking official in the FBI. Was he not third ranking?
I don't know what his standing was.
Yeah. And he kept that secret for more than 30 years. And of course, Woodward and Bernstein kept the secret. Ben Bradley of the Washington Post even know?
I think he did, but I'm not 100% sure.
So on the other hand, there are smaller secrets.
Like what?
Stephen just emailed and said, today, 50 years later, Mom still thinks I locked my bedroom door because I was afraid of the burglars.
877-301-8970. So you can talk about secrets big and small. We just spoke to a man who kept a secret for decades and decades and decades about his role in one of the most important moments in American history in the second half of the last century. It doesn't have to be that big in your case, but are you able to do it? And if you are, why? And if you're not, why not?
You know what's a great secret in Boston lore? I think the lawyer for Charles Stewart has never told the story of what Stewart said or may not have said before he jumped off the Tobin Bridge.
Remember
Charles
Stewart? Lawyer? I don't remember who the lawyer was.
I forget the guy's name, but lawyers.
You know, our friend Nancy Gardner represented the brother. You know,
yeah, she
Matthew.
Did represent. But people don't remember Charles Stewart was the guy who murdered his wife, put a bullet in the back of her head after they were leaving a birthing class at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, then blamed it on some unknown black guy, and most of Boston believed his story. And then, of course, when the cops stopped believing him and they were closing in, he jumped off the Tobin Bridge. But I don't think his lawyer is – he kept that. That's a long time ago, like 25 years or something like that, the Charles Stewart case went down.
How about the secret of the prominent wealthy guy who was involved
with
the prostitute?
Hooker.
Exactly.
We don't know about that either.
Yeah.
Lawyers have to keep a lot of secrets.
They do.
Yeah. That's why you couldn't practice anymore.
Well, you just tell your friends. Then your friends can leave. Isn't that – oh, I'm sorry. That's a violation of the oath. I never did that either. That was a joke. So don't go to the bar or board of bar overseers. Let's take your calls. Let's go. Where do you want to go, Marjorie? You start.
Kira from Carlisle.
Hi, Kira.
Hi there. Hi, Marjorie. And hi, Jim.
Hi.
First of all, mine is so much less.
That's okay. So are the
well,
so
most
are
people
all the
were not going to be involved in saving the world, so it's okay.
Okay, good. Or the CIA. I mean, it's quite remarkable. You know, 50 years later. But I did want to say that there's a great movie that I just saw. I mean, I thought it was quite good. And it's called A Person or the Company We Keep or something like that. It has Robert Redford in it. Great, what I thought was a great cast.
What was the relevance to the secret issue?
Because they were covering up... she got herself into some drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and I don't know exactly how it all conflated, but it was pretty serious. And it was a very well done story. So I came in the middle of it. I was studying the other night, and I thought, wow, this is a really good movie. But anyway, she finally revealed things because she knew it was going to be putting a very close someone in harm's way, plus a child.
Okay, so that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
If you reveal a secret to save someone else from more harm, that's what you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you the kind of person that we could trust if we told you a secret, Kira?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you are? Good. Okay, well,
tell her a secret,
one
Jim.
Of us. I'm not telling anybody any secrets. Kira, thank you very much for your call. You know what? The reason I'm fascinated with the story, beyond its place in history, is I can't imagine. I know you're going to say, oh, big surprise, Jim. Can you imagine playing such an important role in something this important and keeping it to yourself? And other than, I think, the members of the Lavender Hill Mob, as Daniel Ellsberg called them, and I guess their families or loved ones or whatever, nobody knew until this New Yorker story at the end of last month. Can you imagine
that? I thought that
your ego is a little
bit smaller
than mine.
I thought you had a big secret about your stellar year as a city councilor in Cambridge.
No, the only secret I have that I'm not going to is my time at Wawa Supermarket, which you brought up before. That for reasons to protect my coworkers, I decided.
Jim took the fifth.
Okay, let's
go to Dan in the car.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. Second time calling.
Thank you.
Short time listener, but I love your show.
Thank you very much.
I think I can keep a secret, but I could also divulge one.
What does that mean?
Well, basically, I would have to weigh the reason for breaking the promise, and it would have to be to better, you know, outcome than keeping it.
Well, you know, that's why a lot of people, I hadn't thought of this until you made the point you made, there are a lot of people who don't want to be told secrets. You know, there's a parallel in journalism. It's off the record.
Yeah.
Remember the late, great Alan Lupo? Lupo, who was a columnist of the Globe and the Herald. If Alan Lupo called you about a story, he reported on the city about as well as anybody ever did. And
married to a wonderful woman, Carol
Rivers. Alan Lupo would say to you, ask you a question. And if you said to Alan, let's go off the record, he would say, no, I don't participate in interviews or off the record. The point being, he didn't want to put himself in a position, I think it's fair to say, where he had the equivalent of a secret in journalism. But you trust yourself, obviously, enough, Dan, to be able to make the right decision under the right circumstances, which Not all of us do. Dan, thanks for the call. 877-301-8970.
Here's a good one from Sarah. As a nurse, I have been so ingrained with keeping personal information confidential. I never share anything anyone tells me unless they've already made it public. You know, that's another place, a profession. Obviously, nurses, physicians, and you know, you get in the elevator all the time. If you ever go to visit somebody at the Brigham or Mass General, or they have all the signs. Yeah. The signs there, do not discuss patient information. That's a good one.
Because you may see somebody who prefer not to have the public know that he or she is there or what they're getting treated for.
Right. You could recognize. Yeah.
But don't you think, you know, I hadn't thought about this at all until we spoke to Gar a couple of minutes ago. Mm-hmm. That's really the ability to honor a trust and to keep a secret is a really important quality.
My sister is great at that.
Is she really?
Oh, God.
Because she forgets
so
or she's no, honorable?
No, because she's just very honorable about secrets. All this great stuff. She never told me until, like, the person moved away. Well, the person moved away or something changed or whatever, and she can review it. I tell you.
It's very impressive.
A little Peyton Place.
Let's go to Brian and Beverly. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about secret keeping after we spoke to a guy who kept a secret for 50 years. Hi there.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I'm not even 50. I can't believe that guy has kept secrets longer than I am.
I know. Isn't that incredible? For 50 years, he kept the secret. Amazing.
Go ahead, though.
I've always been able to keep secrets. And I'm never anybody who throws people under the bus. You know, I have to say it's happened to me a lot, but I'm good at keeping secrets. I learned even more in how important it is. I had a dream once where the Dalai Lama came to me. And
the Dalai Lama came to you?
He's had in a dream.
Oh, in a dream. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
In a dream. Oh, yeah. 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 He came to my, you know, he knocked on the door. And
said, hey,
I
Brian.
You're not expecting me.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So, anyway, he came to me and he said, you know, I have two really important things to tell you. And I said, okay. And he said, the first thing is the only secrets that you should take with you to the grave are other people's.
Ooh.
And, which I, you know, I was like, oh, wow. You know, and when I woke up, I realized, wow, that also means, like, you know, try to not hold things inside so that they, you know, fester and kill you. Thank goodness that guy didn't die.
Well, that's one of the things, Brian, by the way. One of these stories talks about this interview with a therapist talking about how keeping secrets probably makes you feel worse than you would if you were not keeping a secret. In other words, keeping secrets can be bad for your health, very stressful.
I guess it depends on the type of secret.
Yep.
You know, like if, you know, somebody's saying, like, I have to tell somebody that I'm cheating on my wife.
Right.
Or I killed somebody. That's
a tough one.
Terrible.
Yeah, telling somebody the whole issue of whether to keep a secret or whether you killed somebody is a real dilemma. Thank you, Brian, for the call. The connection's bad. So a story I'm reading as Brian was speaking in the Atlantic, the average person, how many secrets do you think the average person is keeping? Do you read it? If you read it, don't guess. Oh, you didn't read it.
Okay. I didn't read it.
How many secrets is the average person keeping?
I don't know, 7.
13.
13.
How many of them are secrets they have never told another living soul? And I'm actually stunned by this. How many?
I'm sorry, asking the question again?
What, are you not paying attention to the show?
I was reading the email.
Okay, well, why not read the email? Why not talk to me?
Okay,
let's try
ahead.
That for a change.
Okay.
How many of them are secrets they've never told another living soul?
Okay, they're keeping 20?
877-301. No, it's 13, Marjorie.
13.
That
okay,
was a long
keeping,
time ago. I
they're
had
keeping
this discussion
13.
With you.
They've got 13. They're keeping 10.
No, they'd be keeping 5. Do you have
so
any
less than
I'm
half,
talking?
Yes.
That's right. 5 is
less than half.
Than
so the circuit of the secrets they're entrusted to keep, they're keeping less than half.
The most common secrets, you can go back to reading the email, that people shared with no one else were extra relational thoughts, thinking something romantic or sexual about someone other than your partner. Romantic desires, sexual behavior, and lies. No wonder they're keeping him secret.
Yeah, that was the famous Bill Clinton thing, you know, lying about having sex, and he was impeached over it. But many of Americans said, "Gee, they, for the grace of God, go I."
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Meg.
Yeah, the longer we have this conversation, the more I admire this guy, Igor Alperovitz. I mean, the notion that he kept this to himself, Alperovitz, my apologies, is just. It is stunning. It is an act of You know what's another good example of this? Mm-hmm. I hope he doesn't. Does Seth Moulton have an opponent? Because I don't want to. No, he doesn't. So I can say this. Remember the Walter Robinson story about Seth Moulton? Who I don't know if he had been elected yet or not elected yet. And Walter Robinson did a story about the fact that when he had been running, he never, everybody knew that he had done four tours of duty, but he never mentioned that he received medals and honors. And so Walter Robinson goes to Seth's parents, the congressman's parents, my apologies, and says, what do you think about the fact that your son chose to keep that secret? Remember what his parents said?
That they didn't know either.
Until Walter Robinson told them about it. I mean, can you imagine that kind of thing? Keeping your involvement in the Pentagon Papers secret, keeping your involvement, what did he win, a purple? I don't remember what his honors were, but they were not insignificant honors.
Oh, no, they were valor.
Overseas.
They were medals for valor. Yeah, no,
that's
I can't.
That's a whole different kind of secret keeping.
Yeah, I think you'd probably get that out one.
I mean, most of the kind of secrets that Marjorie and I are keeping, the kinds that if you didn't, you'd probably get indicted for. So those are the kinds of secrets. That, you know what I mean?
Let's say I don't know what you mean.
Meg, we have 30 seconds.
I'm sorry.
You're in Washington, D.C. Do it quickly. Hi.
Hi, this is quick. I just wanted to share a quote with you. Benjamin Franklin said that three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead.
So that's pretty good, actually. That was a good way to end the discussion. Meg, thank you.
You know, I want to mention, because I was reading the email, Jim, I discovered that a couple of our listeners had relatives that were code-breakers who kept the secret back from World War II. So there you go. Sometimes it helps.
Wait,
to
is that
read
true?
The email. Yes.
No. Unfortunately, if you say it's true, I accept that it's true.
Okay.
Thank you for your calls. We appreciate it.
Yes, and thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to be down at the Boston Public Library. It's going to be a fun day. We've got our Friday All-Stars, Shirley Leon, Callie Crossley, Emily Rooney. Plus, we've got our annual Valentine's Day news quiz with the great restaurateurs Joanne Chang and her husband Christopher Myers of Myers and Chang, and also Joanne, of course, is of Flower Bakery.
By the way,
the
is this three in a row or four in a row
buns.
For them? They've done it for a number of years. I think Joanne won every year.
Blueberry muffins.
Gets pretty heated between the two of them.
Gets a little heated. That's right. But
that's
okay.
Our quiz
it's
tomorrow.
Valentine's
it's fun.
Day.
Join us tomorrow.
We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boygon, Christina Bieni. Our engineer is John LaCroix Parker. We are a production of WGBH. And we cannot leave without finding out what enticing subjects are going to be discussed tonight.
Pretty good show, actually.
On the Greater Boston.
Thanks for your ridicule. I appreciate it. We've talked a lot about the horror of what's happened in terms of Puerto Rico and how we have helped or not helped our fellow citizens. Well, a bunch of Red Sox went to Puerto Rico to find out. Amongst them was Sam Kennedy, who's the president of the Red Sox. Joining them was the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh. Well, Mayor Walsh and Sam Kennedy will join me tonight to sort of do a debrief. Paul English founded Kayak. He's going to join me with a woman who is in charge of something called Winter Walk Boston that happens this weekend. It's around homelessness. And Andres Nelsons is now not just the music director of the BSO, he's the music director of the oldest orchestra in the world at the same time in Leipzig. Leaders from both orchestras and Andres will join me tonight to talk about this unique collaboration.
Okay, Jim. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. Bye.